Good Friday to you. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornaday Ammunition, right here on Sirius XM Patriot 125, NRA TV, and more. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Cam Edwards, your host, glad you've joined us today. We've got a great show for you. Ed Morrissey from Hot Air will be with us here in just a few minutes, talking about some of the big stories of the day and of the week. Yeah, we'll probably end up talking about Kathy Griffin for a couple of minutes. I mean, I know that's what she wants, and that's what it's all about, but good gravy. From apologies to proclaiming that she is a victim within, what was that, 48 hours? 48 hours. We'll talk about it with Ed and a lot more. Also, later this hour, Thom Balsh with Saddle River Range in Conroe, Texas, a country club there in Conroe, offering what one of the local TV stations calls a unique shooting experience to the public. I'm glad to see that, you know, these are actually still allowed to open up, because we've seen so many stories recently about ranges getting shut down or being told that they can't open up in communities around the country. I mean, this is Texas, and this is Conroe, Texas. They do like their Second Amendment there in Conroe and in the Houston area. But Thom's got an interesting backstory. Former Secret Service agent who is now running the Saddle River Range there in Conroe. So we'll talk with Thom coming up later on in the hour. Also next hour, James Varney from Real Clear Investigations talking about knife law reform. David Harsanyi at The Federalist says Democrats have lost on climate change, and it's their own fault. Plus, in Hour 3, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins of Breitbart joins us, talking about some of the big Second Amendment stories of the day and of the week. And we'll wrap things up with our friend Tony Katz from WIBC in Indianapolis, Indiana. Today is the Wear Orange Day for the anti-gun activists. Kim Kardashian has written a letter on her personal website about the need for stricter gun control. She says she's not against guns, because that's part of the standard line now, right? Not against guns, not against people owning guns. After what happened to me in Paris, she said, I know how important it is to be safe and to have armed security. Yeah, we can't all afford that armed security, but that's good to know. All my security team, she says, is armed, but they also support stricter gun control laws and believe that we should restrict access to firearms for people with mental illness, anyone previously convicted of a misdemeanor, those who've been subject to a temporary restraining order, and those at a, quote, higher risk of committing gun violence, whatever that vague term means. You live in a high-crime neighborhood, maybe you're at a higher risk of committing gun violence. You shouldn't have a gun then. You might need one for self-defense, but based on the Kardashian criteria, sorry, your Second Amendment rights no longer apply. She concluded her letter by saying, I want to help build a safer future for my children, and I believe together that we can find ways to do that while still protecting the rights of the American people. She didn't offer any ideas, just offered hope that one day we would find those ideas. Meanwhile, over at Vogue, Patricia Garcia has a piece, Outraged Over Gun Violence, Here's How to Take Action. Again, very light in the details, I have to say. A little disappointing. We got the hashtag, we got the wear orange, but other than that, we don't really have a lot of policy proposals being offered today. Have you noticed that? Patricia Garcia talked with Shanna Watts of Moms Demand Action, and Garcia says, we asked Watts to share her advice on the best ways to channel outrage and frustration into action. Okay. Some specifics here. Let's get to it. Don't be discouraged by the lack of results in Congress. Be invigorated by it. Watts says the first battle Moms Demand Action decided to engage in was the battle to get the government to pass a background check law right after Sandy Hook. We stood behind the president at press conferences. We had district meetings. We had moms take the hill. We all went to Washington, D.C., and in the end, we lost. That was an inflection point where I thought this was all going to fall apart, and what happened is that we actually doubled in size overnight. Still haven't been able to get their gun control laws through Congress. But says they got bigger. They increased their mailing list. That hasn't reduced violent crime, by the way. Violent crime has gone up in this country since then. But, okay, don't be afraid to think small and local, Shanna Watts says. After Congress failed to pass universal background checks, Vogue writes, Moms Demand Action decided to switch gears and to focus on passing legislation at the state level. One of the first victories, Garcia writes, came after they helped then-Governor Martin O'Malley in Maryland pass sweeping gun reform legislation, which included training requirements for gun owners and a ban on many semi-automatic rifles. Watts says, we very organically pivoted to the states. If Congress wasn't going to do what it needs to do, then we're going to pass these laws where we live. So they went to the states. They went to Maryland. Passed these new gun laws. Training requirements for gun owners, ban on many semi-automatic rifles. Baltimore Sun today. Through May, record number of killings in Baltimore. This is the success story that Vogue is highlighting. We went to Maryland. We couldn't get what we wanted in Congress, and we went to Maryland instead, and we got what we wanted there. 4 years later, record number of homicides through May in Baltimore. A couple of years ago, Baltimore saw, this was after the sweeping gun control laws were put in place. This is 2015. Baltimore saw the highest per capita homicide rate in the city's history. There had been more raw numbers of homicides, but because of the population decline in Baltimore, you had the higher number of per capita homicides in 2015. Now they're talking about the highest raw number of homicides. Declining population, increased homicides, 146 homicides through May 31st in Baltimore, Maryland. 4 years after the sweeping gun control laws that Moms Ban Action and Vogue praising were put into effect, they're looking at record high homicides. And the homicide rate, by the way, has gone up. It's been higher than 2013 for the past 3 years, 2015, 2016, 2017. It's going the wrong direction. But this is one of their success stories. Get inventive with your campaigns. While jamming a representative's phone line is always a good way for constituents to weigh in on an issue, Moms Demand Action came up with another clever strategy to force the conversation. Watt says, we started something called stroller jams. Basically, the halls of the State House would get so filled with moms and babies and baby paraphernalia that lawmakers couldn't pass us without answering our questions and listening to our spiel. We've had them all over the country. What's the spiel? Again, what's the policy proposal that you're stopping to talk to lawmakers about? I mean, it's not quite as important, I guess, as having the stroller jam. Never forget the power of your wallet. Vogue says, aside from focusing on passing gun reform laws, Moms Ban Action has also targeted corporations to change their policies regarding open carry laws. Not really, regarding carry laws. Actually, it's not even laws, it's policies of these companies. And again, it's one of those areas where, you know, they talk the gun safety, they talk the, oh, we're not anti-gun. I'm supportive of concealed carry, just not anywhere where I happen to be. You don't even have to dig down that far to find the conflict in what they're saying. You just have to do a little digging, which apparently Vogue's not interested in doing. No, Vogue says Watts first got the idea to lobby companies directly after Starbucks decided to prohibit smoking up to 25 feet from its stores, regardless of state law. Watts decided to reach out to Starbucks and ask them to also consider banning open carry guns in their stores, but they initially refused. Watts says, we started a campaign that was called Skip Starbucks Saturday. We helped pictures of open carry at Starbucks go viral, and we just kept at it. Within 3 months, then Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz came out on television and said guns were no longer welcome in their stores. Since then, Vogue says, they led several other corporate campaigns with hashtags such as burritos, not bullets, groceries, not guns, shakes, not shotguns, that have successfully pressured Target, Trader Joe's, Chipotle Mexican Grill, and other restaurants and retailers to change their carry policies. I know this is trying to help the anti-gun crowd not hurt it, but just to note, many of these companies have not actually changed their policies at all. Right. Even the companies like Starbucks have said, look, we'd ask you to leave your guns behind, but we're not going to put up signs prohibiting firearms. Right. So they actually haven't changed the policies. What they've done is they've tried to strike that corporate middle ground to get Moms Ban Action to go away. Moms Ban Action gets their press release victory. See, look, aha, we got change. And they are happy with that. The corporations are happy because it's no longer an issue and they haven't really had to do anything. And that's how this works. It's almost like a corporate social responsibility shakedown. Can we turn that into a hashtag, Cameron? Social Shakedown Saturday?
If you want. How about SSS?
Well, they had skip Starbucks Saturday.
That's
so that,
true.
They started the
SSS. We see what a raging success it was, so maybe we should try my method.
Don't know where to start. This is the other bit of advice here. Don't know where to start? Look to your phone. And they give out the number that you can text to learn more about the gun safety group, quote unquote. And finally, run for office seriously. Vogue's Garcia writes, like many women around the country, Shanna Watts was devastated after Donald Trump was elected president last November. She said, I remember I was at the Javits Center that night wearing my white pantsuit, getting ready to celebrate Hillary Clinton's win. And I can remember thinking, what will happen? Will the women and moms that have worked so hard on this issue feel like it's hopeless and want to give up? But once again, Vogue says, the opposite reaction took place. Instead of retreating, hundreds of women in their organization actually decided to run for office in the wake of Clinton's loss. Watts says, we just did a poll of our volunteer base, and more than 200 women plan to run in 2018. Several of them have already filed and are already running in special elections across the country. Watts says, I think in many ways that's part of the solution to this crisis. We need to have more women in office making the laws. I'm not opposed to more women in office making the laws. I'm opposed to more anti-gun activists in office making the laws, regardless of their gender. And again, it'll be interesting to see how that plays out. Will Moms Demand in every town start touting some of these candidates, actually letting us know who these candidates are? Because these candidates, once they run for office, again, politicians often try to get by repeating the same vacuous campaign phrases, right? They try to do that. And maybe they've been able to get away with that for, you know, however many election cycles. But I think we as a voting public are becoming a little cynical, a little jaded, quite honestly. Not able to spout the mindless pablum that you used to be able to spout as a politician. We see beyond the empty rhetoric, and we want a little bit more. So, and again, in these five bits of advice, what we can do to make the world a safer place, there's not really any policy proposals there, is there? There's a lot of things that we can do to make Moms Demand Action a bigger group, things that we can do to make Every Town for Gun Safety have a bigger mailing list, things that we can do to make Big Daddy Bloomberg happy and proud. But there's really nothing offered that's going to reduce violent crime. Again, the one thing that they offer, the one policy proposal that they talk about, the gun control laws in Maryland, which have been an abject, dismal failure in Baltimore, where homicides are at an all-time high. So what can we do, really, to bring down the violent crime rate in places where it's going up, places like Baltimore, Louisville, Kentucky, California, San Francisco, Los Angeles County? We're going to be talking about that this afternoon. But we also have some legislative news to talk about. Constitutional carry, seeing some progress in a couple of states. And we'll talk about suppressors as well. The Hill has a piece on suppressors. Once again, we find some quotes from some anti-gun groups out there who are very unhappy with the Hearing Protection Act. They don't like it. They want to see it go away. And frankly, they don't really have a great argument against it. Their argument should be that it basically boils down to guns should be as loud as possible. For a group that, you know, again, declares itself to be pro-gun, isn't it weird how they've never really found a gun that they are happy with? Some guns are too big, some guns are too small, some guns are too affordable, some guns are too exotic and expensive, right? And now we know some guns can be too quiet. They need to be loud. We'll talk about that coming up as well. Right now, though, we're going to step away for just a moment or two. When we return, our friend Ed Morrissey at Hot Air joins us. There's a lot to discuss with Ed, so stick around. We are just getting started here on this Friday edition of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. Talking with Lieutenant Colonel Robert Ledee from the Armor for Troops Foundation. What is Armor for Troops all about? I mean, it sounds like it might be kind of self-explanatory, right?
We started this in 2005. We realized there was a lot of shortage of equipment overseas, so we started the foundation. We provide anti-ballistic eyewear, Under Armour, multifunction tools, knee pads, elbow pads, antibacterial clothing. You know, you don't, Marines and all military in the war zone don't shower for 2 or 3 weeks. At that point, only your mother will love you. But we provide equipment. We're doing boots, boot pads. We started doing some vests, but they got so expensive we couldn't do it anymore.
Wow, that's still an amazing amount of material that you all are able to supply free of charge to these members of the military.
The boxes we were standing in had a retail of $750 of all the stuff we put in it. In addition to all the equipment, we also put in batteries, toothpaste, toothbrush, disposable shavers, deodorant, clear eyes, lip thing. We had face wipes, hand wipes, foot powder. So we put a big box together.
That is fantastic. And this is all volunteer driven?
Yes, it is. We have zero salaries. Everybody is a volunteer, have been for over 10 years, and no one gets paid anything here.
And how many people have you been able to help since 2005?
Well, we sent out over 46,000 pairs of eyewear alone. So you got to say we've helped over 46,000 people. Doesn't count the thousands of Under Armour and multifunction tools, etc.
That is incredible. Was there anything like this when you were active duty?
No. And I did 31 years in the Marine Corps. So because of what was happening, especially going to a war zone, I remember what Secretary Rumsfeld said. You go to war with what you have, not with what you want. So we started figuring out that there was a shortage of things. We were going to do something that no one else has done. The military did offer equipment. We just gave them better, great equipment.
We're here in Las Vegas, Nevada, SHOT Show 2017, and it is really an honor to be here with McKenna Dahl of USA Shooting. It is so good to see you, McKenna.
Thank you.
So you are, for people who don't know, and you know this, I can't imagine there are people who don't know, you are the first Paralympian to win a medal in shooting at the Olympics, correct?
First female, yes.
First female, all right. Talk about that.
I just thought it was absolutely amazing to be able to represent the United States in USA Shooting so well on the world stage and really show females that we can go after whatever we want to.
Now, what was your event?
I shoot in SH2 prone and standing.
Okay. So when you were, and this was at the Rio Games.
It was.
In 2016. You know, you see it, you know, of course, everyone watches the Olympics, and then at the end you get the medal ceremony, and you see the people, and they play all the anthems, and you're up there. And, you know, you got bronze, so they didn't play your anthem, but you're up there representing the country. And so what does that feel like, just to stand there and know that the United States of America, you're representing this amazing country down in Rio?
It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life. Yeah. I didn't get to hear the anthem, but I did get to see the flag raised, and my parents were able to attend my match.
Oh,
so
cool.
They were there in the stands, you know, crying, cheering, and it was phenomenal. There's almost not even words to describe the entire experience.
Absolutely. So how old are you now?
I'm 20.
Okay. When did you start shooting?
I started shooting, I tried it for the first time when I was 12.
Okay.
Traveling internationally, I was 15 or 16.
Okay. What condition do you have, and how do you work around it when it comes to shooting? Because it's obviously, you know, for a lot of people, it's hard to shoot as they are. I'm the worst shot in the world. But, you know, for you, what condition it makes it harder for you to do it, and what workarounds do you use?
I have arthrogryposis, which is the loss of muscle and contracture of joints at birth.
Okay.
Birth is the worst it'll ever be. I can only improve what I have from here.
Is it? Oh, wow.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's because usually you hear it the other way.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. Good. Okay.
Yep.
Tom Bowes of the Saddle River Range in Conroe, Texas, is going to join us here in about 20 minutes or so. But right now, here on Cam and Company, we are very pleased to have with us our friend Ed Morrissey from Hot Air. Ed, how are you today?
I am well, sir. Thank you for having me on again.
It is always my pleasure. And listen, I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. I really don't. But I did see your colleague at Hot Air, John Sexton, has a piece on the Kathy Griffin press conference earlier today. You know, Ed, I mean, really, if she just would have stopped with the apology, maybe let things die down, right? Let the news cycle continue. But I got to say, I think going and holding a press conference and proclaiming yourself to be a victim, and nothing like this has ever happened before. The president has never gone after a comedian in history. You did have Truman going after some music critics. I don't know if Kathy Griffin's aware of that, but this to me just seems like a really, really bad idea for Kathy Griffin to do, Ed.
Well, I'm gonna give you some breaking news here. This is a scoop. This is an inside scoop at there. Is that we had an editorial meeting and John drew the short straw. So he's the guy who got to write about this. No, I'm just kidding. John did this on his own. It had nothing to do with the fact that I was threatening him on DM on Twitter. I'm sorry, is this live? the thing about this is I actually wrote a column. It ran on Wednesday. And this thing started on Tuesday, right? And it went through the severed effigy head that she's holding up, and then she wrote a couple of defenses of herself on Twitter, and then came the abject apology, and everybody was most people were not accepting of this apology, even though I felt it was, appropriate apology. She took ownership of it. She said it was wrong. She expressed apologies, although not to Trump. And I wrote a column about this the next day saying, we should be prepared to accept people's apologies. Cam, this might be the shortest shelf life of any column I've ever written, because I just kind of assumed that she was being honest about that and that she had some genuine remorse about it. Then she hires Lisa Bloom, who is an attorney cut out of the same cloth as Gloria Allred, and in fact is Gloria Allred's daughter, to have this high-profile Donald Trump is picking on me. He's completely broken me. I'm never going to have a career, and it's all Donald Trump's fault. Press conference this afternoon, which is basically like taking a train wreck, backing it up, and wrecking it all over again, all on your own. It's astounding how bad this has gotten.
It is. Was it Buster Keaton who did the Great Train Robbery, and now Kathy Griffin doing the Great Train Wreck, right?
Yeah. This is like Casey Jones, except that Casey Jones was the engineer on both trains, and he did it twice just because it was too much fun the first time. It's laughable. It's so bad.
My favorite line from the press conference today was from the attorney. It wasn't from Kathy Griffin. Lisa Bloom said that it's clear. The message is clear. Criticize the president, lose your job. Ed, where is that clear? To me, it seems like if you criticize the president, you're pretty much guaranteed a spot on late night television. There's some network that'll put you on.
And not just that, but on cable networks. I mean, there's a whole industry that goes into criticizing the president. And I don't mean just this president. I'm talking about every president. It's a whole industry that goes into this. And maybe it's a little bit more of a boom economy this year because of Donald Trump and the lack of popularity that he enjoys. But, that's absurd. If you criticize the president, you pretty much have especially if you're somebody who's a recognizable face, you pretty much guaranteed that you're going to get a lot of invitations to all the right parties. If, on the other hand, you decide to hold up a severed effigy of the president's head and call it comedy, you pretty much have dug your own career grave there. And today is just an example of the wisdom of the first rule of holes, which is when you find yourself in one, stop digging.
I wonder if Lisa Bloom ever would have taken on that rodeo clown who wore the Obama mask as a client. Because, that guy did get ousted from his job for the – do you remember that a few years ago, Ed?
I do.
The rodeo clown?
I do. I remember when a rodeo clown putting on a Barack Obama mask was the most horrible thing that you could ever do to a president. And to be fair, most people have been criticizing Kathy Griffin over this, from Chelsea Clinton to Mitt Romney to all sorts of different people. The only two people I've seen defending her of any note are Jim Carrey and Larry King. that's not too many people in your corner. Get down to those two.
No. And Larry King, I think Larry King thinks he's defending D.W. Griffin. The old movie director.
Very nice.
Sorry, that was very ageist of me. I will, I'll give myself a wrist slap during the break. All right, so on to other topics here, on to more important topics. Donald Trump yesterday in the Rose Garden announcing that he is walking away from the Paris Climate Accords. And as I understand it, Ed, the Earth is now literally on fire. That seems to be the reaction from some people.
You know, the most amusing part of this is that the Paris Accords really didn't do anything except burden us with funding some climate-related legal funds to the tune of about 100. Overall, the signatories were going to contribute to this fund and to a tune of about $100 billion a year. Without any doubt, we were going to be supplying a lot of that cash. But other than that, this was a completely voluntary framework. There's no enforcement mechanisms here. And each nation was tasked to come up with their own targets and their own measures of measuring against the targets, and then their own measurements. And the only penalty for noncompliance was going to be a bunch of finger wagging at cocktail parties. Basically, I mean, that's all this is. If you take a look at the actual text of this, that never once mentions the word enforce, and the only mention of compliance is when it establishes a compliance committee. I believe it's Article 15, in which the measures taken to ensure compliance have to be non-punitive. So it's literally an agreement to join a club. And that's pretty much it. I mean, and that cuts both ways. I mean, there's a great argument for not leaving it, because it's just meaningless at this point. You can maybe you can say, well, you're going to drag your heels on the funding, or you object to the funding. Barack Obama wrote the targets. You could always just rewrite those targets and claim that that's what you're going to go by. And I don't think that you were going to get thrown out of the club for doing that. There were maybe other ways of handling the issues that Donald Trump rightly highlighted yesterday. I'm actually of the mind that it wasn't worth the diplomatic damage that was done yesterday to pull out of what is essentially a meaningless document.
That's interesting, because we might actually disagree a little bit on this, because I agree with you on the largely meaningless aspect of this, except for the financial burden that, as you say, inevitably we would be saddled with. But I think that this was, look, whatever diplomatic damage was done, I think that this was also, you know, the line that I think will be the takeaway from President Trump's comments yesterday was, I was elected to represent Pittsburgh, not Paris, right? And, you know, as much symbolism as this was about, I think that that was a much needed sign that, you know what, when it comes to the global economy, we're not going to forget about the people who are working in Pittsburgh. There's a reason why it's unbelievably cheap to manufacture in, you know, Central America, why we have call centers opening up in Ecuador and Honduras now instead of in Houston. And to have the president actually, you know, tell the American people, you know what, I'm on your side here. I think that was important. And frankly, I think there were a lot of Americans who would say, you know what, if it bothered the diplomats, too bad, because it made me feel good. And that can be a selfish attribute to have. But I don't know. I don't see it as a necessarily a bad thing.
I think the short-term domestic politics are undeniable, right? I mean, I agree with you. That is a great line. I was elected to represent Pittsburgh and not Paris. I think that's a great line. It's a great way of explaining it, too. I just don't think that it's necessarily going to get Pittsburgh anything better than what it already had. And here's what I think is going to happen. And because I'll tell you, the way that they're exiting this agreement is curious. They are arguing that they're arguing that the U.S. isn't truly committed to this anyway, because it wasn't submitted as a treaty and ratified by the Senate, which, by the way, is absolutely true. It might be worth pulling out of this type of agreement just to set the precedent that we're not going to enter into these kinds of agreements in the future unless the Senate ratifies it and passes it as law. So I actually like that precedent. But they're going to withdraw based on the terms and conditions of the Paris Accord that they're rejecting. It's going to take 4 years to pull out of this thing. And which is, by the way, the target date would be the day either just before or just after the 2020 presidential election, because it's in the first week of November. And so if you think that it's an illegitimate deal and you think it's a bad deal, why are you not just pulling out immediately? Well, I think the answer is that Donald Trump wants to try to renegotiate this so that he can claim some sort of marginal improvement over nothing, over a complete lack of any sort of commitment whatsoever, which is going to be hard to top, by the way, and then renegotiate it and claim that he's the guy who made a better deal on this, and now you have to love me because I'm back on board with the whole, you know, climate protection gig. I foresee something like that happening. And France, Germany, and Italy yesterday said, well, we can't renegotiate this accord. It's already been negotiated. And Donald Trump's going to say, well, you either renegotiate it or we're going to stay out. You've got 3 years plus to make up your mind on it, about 3.5 years to make up your mind on it. And I suspect sometime maybe early next year, you're going to hear about some concessions being made to the Trump administration so they can re-enter the Paris Accords by rewriting the NDCs, you know, the standards in terms of our contribution to this, and plus relieving us of some of the cost of the legal fund that we're supposed to be maintaining, $100 billion over 5 years for all the signatories put together. And when that happens, Donald Trump will get us right back into the Paris Accord, and then it'll be curious to see if he actually submits it to the Senate as a treaty, or if he's going to continue Obama's precedent of having off-the-books accords, international accords, that we are expected to somehow comply with.
All right. We will see in the months ahead, Ed. I'm gonna write this down. I'm going to put this in an envelope, and we'll pull out your prediction when it becomes appropriate. All right, we've only got a couple of minutes left here, and I want to get to your piece, Dems to Hillary. We're getting pretty tired of the view under your bus. This has been fascinating because we have watched since the election. Well, first we saw Hillary Clinton wandering through the woods and getting stopped in supermarkets. But when she started speaking out publicly about the election, we heard a lot of blame casting, and a lot of people on the left went along with the blame casting. Yeah, she's right. It was Russia, and yeah, it was misogyny, and it was, yeah, until it became the DNC, right? This week, we heard about the problems with the DNC and the data operation from Hillary Clinton, and she started with basically nothing. And all of a sudden, now the left, Ed, as you point out, they're a little tired of Hillary Clinton making all these excuses.
Yeah, they're getting a little tired of being the scapegoat all of a sudden. And look, I mean, I think that this is, first off, I think it was inevitable because eventually she was going to come around and start blaming some of her allies on the left, just as well as some of her opponents on the right, and the media and the Russians and voter suppression and, you know, the creek got overrun, acts of God, force majeure, whatever it is. She's going to blame anything and everything except herself. And so Democrats were eventually going to go under this bus too. And it's interesting because these are the same people who would have to be her allies if she wanted to make any sort of a comeback, or if she wanted to push a political career ahead for her daughter. And right now, everybody who would normally be her ally, meaning the Democratic establishment, the DNC being the establishment, is now under attack by the Clintons, and that's all they had left. I mean, it's literally all they had left. So I this is sort of a, it's not just burning your bridges, it's like burning your entire chain of supply. these guys are going to be out in the wilderness, and they're going to be out there for a really long time. I think that I think the Clintons have basically just poisoned the well. Just to throw in another analogy, I think they've basically poisoned the well for a good long while to come now.
I think you're right. Meanwhile, I expect Joe Biden, who just launched a PAC this week, to start singing the praises of all those hardworking data miners at the DNC. Joe knows how to politic, I think, a little bit, actually quite a bit better than Hillary Clinton does.
Well, I agree, and I think if Joe Biden had gotten into the race, even if he'd gotten in late, he probably would have been the nominee, and I think he would have won the election because Joe Biden would have known to go to Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and he knows how to talk to voters in those areas. And so I think Republicans should consider themselves lucky that Biden didn't get in. He's going to be 76, 77 in 2020, so that's kind of out there, but you don't usually have a guy – like Biden, who's been around for a really long time, who's going to launch a brand new PAC to start making endorsements in the 2018 races without having an eye on the presidential nomination. I mean, that's a real traditional thing for politicians to do, to form PACs, to support House and Senate candidates in a midterm in order to start preparing for the next presidential cycle. And Biden knows that. And just the fact that he's doing that is going to be preemptive somewhat of other Democrats doing that, because he's going to get some donors and he's going to soak up some of the money. And Biden knows that, too. So yeah. I say that, you know, I would not be surprised to find out that Biden is at least somewhat serious at the moment at looking at his opportunities in 2020.
I think you're right. I would almost rather talk about Kathy Griffin than the 2020 election, to be honest with you, Ed, because that just so far away. But I suspect that in 2020 you'll see almost a mirror of what we saw in the Republican primary in 2016. I don't think there will be a clear-cut favorite, even somebody who may be able to wrap up some of those donors early. There are going to be a lot of folks who think this is my year, right? And the more crowded the field, then the lower the bar for me to gain real progress. I think it's going to be the another cannonball run primary, but it'll be for the Democrats in 2020. And that's all I'm going to say about the 2020 elections for the rest of 2017. That's it.
Wise choice. A wise choice.
All right, man. Listen, I appreciate you coming on the program. Unfortunately, we got to take a break, but hope you have a fantastic weekend. We'll do this again soon.
Sounds good, sir. Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you, Ed. Ed Morrissey from Hot Air with us here on Cam and Company on Twitter at Ed Morrissey and online at hotair.com. Tom Bolsch of the Saddle River Range in Conroe, Texas, going to be with us. One of the country clubs open in the Houston area. Stick around. We'll be back with more Cam and Company next.
Phil Schreier, NRA Museums. What is your exact title these days? It's hard to keep up with
what
you.
What day is it?
Yeah, exactly. It's
Senior Curator, National... Or no.
See, you don't even know.
I don't even know.
That's embarrassing.
Hold on. I have a business card in my pocket.
Go ahead. Read off your business card.
Senior Curator, NRA Museums.
All right. Good.
We've expanded. It used to be just Senior Curator, National Firearms Museum, but right. we're growing.
That's why I ask, you know, because you're right. What day? Because you always have something going on. So, you know, for people who don't know, obviously you know, people know the NRA and National Rifle Association, but the museums that you guys have literally across the country are absolute treasures and gems, you know, starting with the main one in Fairfax where the NRA headquarters is. Talk about the museums around the country.
Well, our best kept secret is we're over 80 years old.
Wow.
You know, we opened the doors in Washington, D.C. in 1935 at the bar building at Farragut Square, which still stands.
Was that a good day for you?
It was. It was my first day on the job.
That's right.
It was the second year of the FDR administration.
Is that when you interned?
Yes, I was interning. Back then, the NRA was comprised mostly of retired Army, Navy, Marine Corps guys.
Okay.
So the NRA salute was, that was the NRA salute back in the old days. And
big Shecky Schreier.
And we were right across the street from the Army-Navy Club.
Okay.
So no work got done after 2 o'clock in the afternoon. No, nothing. And then we moved away from the Army-Navy Club to get some work done. In 1954, we opened a new museum at Scott Circle right across the street from the Australian Embassy. And we stayed there until 1994. Mm-hmm. And we moved to Fairfax, and we opened up our flagship museum. 20,000 square feet, 3,000 guns on exhibit, a collection of nearly 8,000 guns. So you can imagine 3,000 guns in 20,000 square feet. That's a lot of guns in a small area. And any more guns, we had no more. So Johnny Morris, wonderful, generous individual at Bass Pro, offered the second floor of his flagship store in Springfield, Missouri. Mm-hmm. And so we opened up the National Sporting Arms Museum 3 years ago. We're ecstatic to report we just had our 1 millionth visitor.
Did you really? Wow.
1 million visitors have been through that so far.
One of the coolest things working here on NRA News, NRA TV, is we were there for the opening, and we did some live shows from there. And it's not being from that area and learning that Bass Pro in Springfield is the biggest tourist attraction in the state of Missouri.
It is.
So you already had that built-in audience, and then you have people who are coming in for the museum. So I would imagine it's an easy feat to get that many people in there. It's stunning. It's a spectacular space.
Yeah, when they ran the numbers by me, I was because we get 50,000 in Fairfax, and you would think, you know, being right by Washington D.C., we'd be have more respectable turnout. But we're outside the Beltway.
Yep.
We're not serviced by the subway system, so. And then the Frank Brownell Museum in the Southwest over at the Whittington Center. That's another fantastic installation out there, opened in August of 2008. And it's actually undergoing a capital campaign right now. They're trying to expand that. They're going to triple its size.
That's cool. So you obviously have a lot going on. If you had, of all the places and all the guns, what's your favorite gun that's on display somewhere?
Oh, well, there's no question that it's the Colt Browning potato digger that we found hidden in the basement of a brownstone in Manhattan. That
That's the only place there are guns, by the way.
Right, yeah.
Somewhere in the brownstone.
hidden in the basement of a brownstone. And it was used by Roosevelt's Rough Riders in Cuba in 1898. It is the first machine gun ever used by the U.S. Army in combat. And we have one of the two on loan from the National Park Service at Sagamore Hill National Historic Site on Long Island.
That's awesome.
Who are just over the moon ecstatic. They've lent it to us for a number of years, and we hope to have it a number of years more.
That's awesome. If people want to find out more, you know, where should they go online? And then you also have stunning visual. You get pictures, you got videos all over the place, too.
We have an amazing website it's grown considerably. We have every gun that's on the wall in the museum is high digital, high res images on our site. And multiple views. So if you wanted to turn it over upside down, we've got the photography. We have beauty shots of our what we call our national treasures, our favorite guns. And that's it at NRAMuseums.org. And you can visit us in Fairfax.
Welcome back to your first source for Second Amendment news and information. It is Cam and Company here on NRA TV and Sirius XM Patriot 125. Cam Edwards, your host, at Cam Edwards on Twitter. We've got James Varney with Real Clear Investigations joining us next hour, talking about knife laws around the country. And, you know, we've been talking about ranges this week. A couple of proposed ranges in Illinois shot down by local communities, including a country club that was scheduled to open up in a Chicago suburb. So I was thrilled today to see a profile of the Saddle River Range at ABC 13 KTRK in Houston, Texas. And it was a glowing profile of one of these country clubs that's actually open for business. I like to see that. And the owner of Saddle River Range, Tom Bolse, is with us on the program right now. Tom, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great, Cam. How are you?
I am fantastic. Thanks for coming on the program, talking about Saddle River Range. And how long have you guys been open there in Conroe?
We've only been open 18 months now, but it's been a great 18 months. Got a lot of support from the community, and, you know, we're in Texas, so a little different than Illinois.
Yeah, unfortunately for the folks in Illinois. But this is one of the things that I wanted to talk with you about because, you know, I imagine that there are some commonalities that that every prospective range owner is going to go through. What was the process like within the community? Was there opposition that you had to deal with and had to kind of explain how ranges work when you were presenting your plans to the city leaders there in Conroe?
Believe it or not, Cam, nothing. I was fully prepared for that. I hired a developer who's built four or five ranges of the same size and type of range that we built here, who told me to expect it, and I was waiting for it, but nothing. Got through all my approval process, permits, everything went swimmingly. I didn't have to report to any government entity and state anything that I was doing. And we did everything by the book from the get-go. Of course, you know, you have your fire marshal that comes out and the building inspector and stuff like that, but nothing was anti-gun, nothing was anti-firearm, and I was very fortunate for that.
That is fantastic because, you know, some of the things that we hear about, there was a range in Elgin, Illinois that was getting ready to open up, and like half a block down the street, Tom, there's a daycare facility. And so you have people complaining, oh my gosh, you know, we got this daycare facility half a block down the street. This is an indoor range that we're talking about. Can you just kind of explain to people the safety precautions? Do people need to, you know, do your neighbors there in Conroe, are they concerned? Do they have any reason to be concerned? Or is this, are we talking about a self-contained space here?
It absolutely is. And there's another range trying to open up in Ramsey, New Jersey, and that's where I'm originally from, that area. And they are getting so much pushback from the local government. And I offered my services to them to come and assist them with some of the talking points that the anti-gun community is really putting out there. So there is no noise factor. That's one thing you hear a lot. There is no lead exposure if you're filtering your range like we are. There really is no danger to the community. You know, the people who are anti-ranges are the same people who are anti-gun because the only thing they know about guns is what they watch on TV. And that is on your nightly news that a gun was used in an armed robbery or the home invasion or hurt somebody. They really have no knowledge base of what the gun culture and the gun industry is all about. We are here to teach safety. We are here to help people learn their way, navigate through buying their first gun, shooting their first gun. We're here about, just like the NRA, we're here for the education of the local community. And we really try to get that message out here at Saddle River Range.
You know, I'm so glad to hear you say that the folks who are anti-range or anti-gun, because these are also, in many cases, Tom, the same individuals who claim to be, quote-unquote, gun safety advocates. And this is something that we point out on Cam & Company all the time. If you're a gun safety advocate, you should be pro-range, right? You should want as many people as possible to have access to as many ranges as possible to get that education and training, because otherwise you're not going to get it. And so I'm glad to hear you say that and to point that out. I'm really glad to hear you say that you're working with the folks in Ramsey, because we've been talking about what's going on up there as well. And you know, again, this could be such a huge benefit if for no other reason than the tax base and the tax revenue that a entity like this could provide to a town. I can't understand why there is such vociferous opposition in some of these localities, other than, as you say, the lack of education, the lack of information, and hopefully that's a matter of just getting that information out in front of people. What has been the impact in the past 18 months with Saddle River Range being open? What's been the impact for Conroe? Has it been a boon to the city? Have you been providing some tax revenue to the city?
Absolutely. We're doing pretty good with sales. We have memberships, different levels of membership. We also include archery in here. So we have training classes and we have two archery bays here. So yeah, during the weekends, especially, as you know, the shooting sports are take off on the weekends when people are off. So our parking lot's full. We have massive events. We just had a wonderful Memorial Day event and people had to park on the street. There were so many people here. So it's really been great for the community. We give back as much as we can because our community has supported us and we try to support the community.
That's fantastic. I'm suffering from country club envy. We have nothing like this in Farmville, Virginia, Tom. I got to tell you, not only do you have the incredible range, but you've got Cafe 2A. Love the name. You've got the Crockett Club. I mean, this, we talk about the country club. This really is you could spend a day right at the range there in Conroe.
Yeah, and that's what we try to do, Cam. We didn't want it to be, you know, your father's or grandfather's range where you come in, you shoot a few rounds, and you go home. We have created a destination here. We have widescreen TVs throughout. Of course, during sports seasons, we got basketball games on, and we got football games on during football season. We have Wi-Fi throughout. People come in, get a sandwich, get a cup of coffee, and they do work at one of the tables there because we have Wi-Fi for them so they can do all their work, and then they go out and shoot. So it's really been a great addition to the area, and people come and they meet friends here, and it's really become a family affair. And as you probably know from going into other gun stores over the years and gun ranges, you know, the reputation is that gun ranges and gun stores never treated you that well. It was, in some ways, it was almost like a competition who knows more about guns. Well, we really brought customer service to the gun industry here. So we greet people with a smile. We assist them in anything they need. If you come in and tell us that, you know, you're a novice or you've never held a gun before, we're going to make sure that you know what you're doing before you go out on the range. And we will bring you out on the range to make sure you know the basic safety rules, that you know how to handle and operate that gun. Some people, as you know, don't even know how to load a magazine. So we'll help them with all those steps. So their first or maybe even second experience is a good experience. We want them to come back. We want them to be comfortable with it. And some of the people that come in for the first time, they're actually nervous. They're very scared. But when they walk out, they're all smiles. And that's what we want to see. When people walk out of the range, they use the words like exhilarating or quite an experience or empowering. We have a lot of women who come in and shoot with us, and they use the word empowering. So we're trying to help out as many people as we can, from novice to expert.
That is fantastic. Again, we're talking with Tom Bowles from Saddle River Range in Conroe, Texas. And Tom, KTRK reported in their piece that you are a retired Secret Service agent. I've got to ask you, how did you decide to make this transition from Secret Service to range owner?
Well, I'll tell you, after the president's detail, I did President Clinton's last 2 years and President Bush's first 3 years. I was transferred out to our training division. And you know what? I just loved it. I love being an instructor. I love teaching tactics and protection and weapon handling. And I then got transferred after that to Houston. The Secret Service loves to transfer us. So I got down here to God's country, loved it down here. And as I was approaching retirement age, I said, well, what can I do with that? What can I do with my 25-year career? What I love to do? How do I give back? How do I help the public sector, maybe with some of the things I learned from working for the Secret Service? So at first, I just wanted to open up a training academy because that was my passion. That's what I really love to do. But then I realized there's plenty of them out there, from former law enforcement like I was to special forces guys that have all this type of training that they're offering. So it's then that I discovered these newly popping up gunnery clubs. There was only 10 of them in the nation at the time. And I went and visited almost half of them. I took bits and pieces from each one of them. Of course, with the internet, you can go and search and see what they're putting out there, what they have. And, you know, some have full restaurants in them and open bars. That's not where I wanted to go with the first one. We might have a full-blown restaurant in the future. Right now, we're pretty happy with the Cafe 2A, simple sandwiches, food, salads, and even archery. Archery was an area we wanted to explore, and we put it in there. And then, of course, classrooms to teach classes and the training simulator. So I got all my ideas from other ranges that were popping up. And now there's, I think, 30 or 40 that are already open and probably double that amount that are at some form of construction or development. So it's really taken off, and I'm happy to see that because that means the shooting sports are here to stay, of course, and people are taking the time to train with their guns and not just go in and buy them.
Absolutely. And I think that we've seen that over the past couple of years. You know, even as the gun sales were surging, these weren't, I don't think there were customers that were just interested in buying a gun and putting it up on a shelf somewhere. They wanted to actually be comfortable. They wanted to be trained. They wanted to feel proficient and know that they were proficient with the firearms that they were buying, because a lot of them were buying the firearms specifically for self-defense.
Yeah, absolutely. And we teach, of course, what they call down here in Texas, license to carry, the LTC course, which is a concealed handgun permit. And I will tell you, probably 95% of the people understand that that just teaches you the law, what you're allowed to do with that gun, where you're allowed to carry it. But it really teaches you nothing about safe operation of that firearm and making sure you're comfortable with it, with that particular gun. So we always offer and we recommend follow-up training with that, whether you take that training before the LTC class or you take it after. But and most of them take us up on it because they are responsible gun owners. They do want to know how to operate that gun and how to keep that gun safe when it's not on your person. So we make all
Absolutely.
The recommendations, and I'll say the vast majority follow our recommendations with safes and vaults and making sure you're not leaving the gun on a nightstand anymore. Those days are long gone.
Well, listen, Tom, I do appreciate you coming on the program. Unfortunately, we're coming up to the end of the hour here. But thank you for joining us today. It's been a real pleasure to talk with you, and I hope that we can have you back at some point.
Absolutely. I'd love to, Cam. Thank you for the time.
All right. Thank you, sir. Enjoy the weekend. Tom Bowles at Saddle River Range in Conroe, Texas. If you're there in the Houston area, the Woodlands, I think Woodlands just south of Conroe, Texas. Now you got a new place to go. And I'm waiting. We've got some gunnery clubs up in Northern Virginia, but we don't have anything like that in Farmville. We're blessed with a lot of acreage and a lot of land where people can go and shoot and plink on their property. But that could be a blessing and a curse, because there are so many people who have their own places to shoot that, we don't have a really good indoor range. Got to drive to Richmond or Lynchburg, but who knows? Maybe one day we will have a gunnery club opening up in Farmville. We have a brewery apparently opening up in the fall here. Meanwhile, there was another range story out of Tennessee, the Tennessean. Another range shut down, proposed range shut down, I should say, Robertson County, Tennessee. The Board of Zoning Appeals has denied a request there in Robertson County that would have paved the way for an outdoor gun range at a recreational camp for the second time in a year after dozens of area residents turned out late last week to speak against the project. That according to the Tennessean and Nashville. It's Camp Sycamore Creek. It's a nonprofit camp that serves inner city youth and other groups. It's on 24 acres, and the owner of this camp wanted to put in a range so that he could host concealed carry courses about six times a year. Said no because of complaints. There's a twist to this story. We'll tell you about it when we come back here. Also next hour, James Varney with Real Clear Investigations, David Harsanyi at The Federalist, and more of the day's top Second Amendment news and information. Stick around. We'll be right back here on Cam and Company.
This is a very unique race here, the Bass Pro NRA 500 here in Bristol. Give you a little feel for Bristol. You go around it in about 15 and a half seconds. And you got 40 cars on a half-mile racetrack. It's really, really tight.
Even though it's a tight racing and rough racing, you got to be patient. You can't tear your car up too early. You got to be able to be around at the end.
Things happen so fast, and that's what makes it just an awesome place to be, because there's action all over the track for the fans to watch and see.
Our fans, you will not find a more patriotic sport than NASCAR. These fans love our freedom, our Second Amendment, our Constitution, our liberty. That's what this country was built on. That's the kind of people that our fans are, our drivers. And it just gives me great honor to be here.
What makes Bristol so special is this is the last great Coliseum, and you can tell by when you first walk in this place, when you look up and you're surrounded by fans, the track is so banked and you're right on top of the action.
I came to Bristol probably in 1969 for the first race. Probably had 10 to 15,000 seats in the grandstand. There's an old guardrail around it. People sat on the grass banks in the back of it. And it was asphalt. And today, the track holds 160,000 people. It's the last great Coliseum, I guess you would want to call it. It builds so much energy for the fans. It builds so much energy for the drivers and pit crews. So it has something very special about it. That's why they say it's Bristol, baby.
Things just happen quicker here. You know you got to stay in the race to win the race.
It's real tight racing. It's bumper to bumper, and you got to move people and make things happen.
As a driver, I had a lot of fun. Some of my best finishes were here. You know, Austin Dillon and Ty Dillon are grandsons, and they both race in NASCAR. As a car owner, I've had cars to finish 1, 2, 3, one to race, finish second, third. And we've also, as a car owner, loaded three of them on the rollback and took them home. So it can go either way. It's feast or famine at Bristol. Now I look back and think how it was on my daughter and my wife when I was driving. So I guess I'm getting payback for that, would you say?
I had to put myself in a good position, and it sucks for Ty. He had such a good run going, and the moves he was making were really impressive. And we just kind of let the race come to us. We had a good car all night, a third and fourth place car. And when it all said and done and everything played out, we were the car to win. So it was a bummer for him, but I'm glad we're in victory lane. Go up that hill, I get to do a burnout on the way up. All the history that's taking place here and to be a part of it is special.
We'll take it any way we can get it. We love these fans here at Bristol. They were cheering loud over there in the front stretch and burning it down. And hopefully we can do something like this come tomorrow night. Love this place, and I want to get as many fans as we can in here this week.
TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour two of Cam and Company starts right now here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Cam Edwards, your host, coming to you once again from beautiful and historic Farmville, Virginia, where we have a lot of things. Don't have a country club, but we have a lot of things going for us. James Varney with Real Clear Investigations coming up later on in the hour. David Harsanyi at The Federalist as well. And we were talking right before the break about another prospective range not allowed to open up, this time in Tennessee, Robertson County, Tennessee. Camp Sycamore Creek, the owner of this camp for inner-city youth and other groups, wanted to put a outdoor range there on the property, wanted to host concealed carry courses there about six times a year, but once every other month. Frankly, it doesn't sound like a big deal to me, but you had the Not In My Backyard crowd, the NIMBYists, come out and complain during the zoning board meeting, and request that would have allowed this range to proceed was denied. Now, here's the twist of the story. The Tennessean quotes the Robertson County Director of Planning and Zoning, Doug Van. And it kind of sounds like Doug Van thought this wasn't a big deal either. He said the board has stopped this range from being built so that the concealed carry classes can't take place six times a year or so. He said, but what those neighbors up there don't understand is that this owner is just like anyone else in the county. He can go on his own property and shoot anytime he wants to. He can take a group of friends and go shoot. There's nothing that can stop him from doing that. Oh. So all of the neighbors complaining, well, we don't want this range going in here. We don't want the sound of the gunfire. Well, you're not going to get rid of the sound of the gunfire. Because that can still happen. You can still go plinking on this property. Sounds like, I bet he will. The executive director of this camp is also the owner of the Nashville Armory. Wants to use the camp as a practice facility for those who are seeking their concealed carry license, and then he wants to use the proceeds from the classes to supplement the operation of the camp for inner-city youth. Again, sounds like a really good idea to me, but apparently not to the neighbors. Van said the about 40 people packed the meeting room to hear the board's discussion and decision. He said few of them spoke, but he said the neighbors' concerns hadn't changed much in the year between meetings. He said they worried about everything from public safety to increased noise. He said some neighbors worried that because more guns will be brought into the camp, the area might see more illegal hunting and poaching. Yeah. Camp Sycamore Creek currently includes a dining hall, athletic facilities, ropes courses, 11 cabins that sleep more than 100 people. They put more than 500 campers through the facility each and every summer. May have been able to put some more through, but not in my backyard, says the neighbors in Robertson County, Tennessee. Won't stop the plinking, won't stop recreational shooting from taking place, but they did stop a range from being built, so aren't they proud of themselves? You know, again, this is, I think, where the lack of education and the lack of information really, really comes into play, because I bet a lot of those folks thought, well, you know, what if we say no to this range? Ha ha, we don't have to worry about the noise. Nah, if that's what's bugging you, you're still going to hear it because they're still going to be shooting. Now, maybe they'll get behind the Hearing Protection Act. Maybe they would be supportive of the suppressor laws changing in this country so that the noise level will go down a little bit. I kind of doubt that too, though, honestly. They didn't stop the shooting. What they stopped was the construction of a range. Well, they stopped ultimately was the ability of some people to train in this facility to get their concealed carry license and then use those proceeds to benefit at-risk youth. That's all they stopped. That's nothing to be proud of. That's nothing to cheer about. All right, some things that we do have to cheer about. I'm happy to report. In North Carolina, permitless carry is advancing here, WCNC reporting. House Bill 746. Voted out of committee yesterday. Next stop is the House floor in North Carolina. Chris Millis, the Republican representative who is sponsoring House Bill 746, says this bill would allow law-abiding citizens to be able to carry concealed regardless of obtaining the mandatory government permit. And this ability to carry concealed is only in places where it's currently allowable to openly carry a firearm. In other words, you can open carry in North Carolina without a permit, but you can't put on a jacket. You have to make sure that your shirt doesn't fall over your holster. This would change that. If you're legally allowed to own that firearm, if you're legally allowed to possess that firearm, if you're legally allowed to openly carry that firearm, you would also be legally allowed to conceal carry that firearm. WCNC says gun control advocates say the concealed carry permit offers extra backup and ensures that gun owners have basic safety training. Christy Clark of Moms Demand Action told members of the House Judiciary 4 Committee, this bill would roll back one of North Carolina's core public safety laws by allowing people to carry hidden loaded handguns in public with no permit and no firearm safety training. Now, again, keep in mind, this is the same group who's opposed to firearms training in Colorado right now for educators. This is the same group that is opposed to ranges opening up in cities across the country. This is the same group that said, I think their chapter leader in Colorado Springs said, we're not trying to take anybody's guns away. We just don't want to see them proliferate. We don't want anybody new becoming a gun owner, in other words. This is also, by the way, the same movement that objected to concealed carry 30 years ago with much the same objections, right? You got a bunch of untrained, unprofessional people. In fact, every now and then you'll still hear this argument made. In fact, I think in Colorado you did hear that argument made by the Moms Demand Action leader in Denver, I think it was, who's a former teacher. He said, I would never carry a gun. These people, even with the training, I just leave it up to the professionals. That's what they're there for. Well, you know, again, we can't all have our own private security. We're not all Kim Kardashian. And the fact of the matter is that we don't have a one-to-one law enforcement officer to citizen ratio in this country. You will likely not have a police officer right by you if you ever are the victim of a violent crime. Chances are, for however many minutes, however many moments, you're going to be your own first responder, right? It's going to be you calling 911. It's going to be you protecting your life. It's going to be possibly you protecting the life of somebody else. But there's not going to be a cop right there. It will take time. They will get there as quickly as possible, but it will take time. WCNC quotes Representative Deb Butler, Democrat from New Hanover, says that she worries that removing the permit process puts the onus on individuals to determine if they are qualified to carry a gun. She said, I do see a paradigm shift in the way we are treating this, and I do see that we are eliminating a very valuable stopgap measure. She said, gun violence has proliferated like crazy in this country. We all know that. Actually, until 2015... violent crime, including gun-related crime, had been declining for 25 years in this country, not proliferating. And states that have adopted permitless carry have not seen a huge surge in violent crime. We've talked about Arizona. They put constitutional carry on the books back in 2010. Their violent crime rate and their homicide rate has declined every year since. I know that, and you know that, because you listen to this program. I don't know that Representative Butler there in North Carolina is aware of that. She said, my fear is that we are asking citizens to disqualify themselves, to understand and know whether they are capable of carrying a weapon in an open fashion, and I just think that's a dangerous step to take. I don't even know what that means. Again, the open carry of a firearm allowed without a license, the concealed carry of a firearm in North Carolina, not. So, again, the representative says, my fear is we're asking citizens to disqualify themselves, to understand and know whether they're capable of carrying a firearm in an open fashion. You know, this suggests to me an attitude, and I don't know that this is the case when it comes to Representative Deb Butler. there from New Hanover. But it suggests an attitude that the peasants can't keep track of themselves, right? That we need to be here in order to disqualify these individuals, in order to tell them, no, you haven't met our standards yet, because if you leave it up to the peons, well, they're just going to run roughshod. They're going to carry guns. They're not going to care if they know how to use them or not. Think about you. Think about the gun owners you know. Think about the people who carry for self-defense that you know. Did any of them has any gun owner who carries for self-defense ever said to you, I don't really need to know how it works. I don't need to take a gun safety class. You just stick it in there and then you pull it out and you pull the trigger, right? It's not how it works. You know, most people don't take the decision to carry a firearm for self-defense lightly in the first place. Oftentimes when you see stories, let's say after a San Bernardino attack or an attack in Orlando, you'll see stories where the local TV station will go out or the reporter for the local paper will go out to the gun stores and they'll talk to the people who are inevitably standing in line to buy a firearm because gun purchases surge there. Rarely, though, in fact, I wouldn't even say rarely, I've never seen somebody quoted as saying, you know what, I went to bed last night anti-gun. I woke up today, I saw the news, and I said, holy crap, I don't know the first thing about guns, but I want one now. Those aren't the people who are showing up. Instead, you get people who say, yeah, you know, I've been thinking about this for a couple of years. I used to own a gun, used to shoot when I was a kid, put it away, then I've been thinking about it. This is something that people take very seriously. They're talking about protecting their life. They're talking about carrying a firearm. That's not something that people take lightly. And it's not something that people, generally speaking, decide, yeah, I don't really need any education on this. I'm good to go as it is. Again, you want that training. You want that proficiency. It's not a matter of a mandate. It's not a matter of you get X hour of training. It's you. You get as much training. You keep training. Every time you go to the range, you're training. Every time you dry fire at home, you're training. It's not something that you're, you know, it's 4 hours and you're done. You're good to go for the rest of your life. It is a mindset. It's a continuing process. And it's something that I just don't think the anti-gun activists and anti-gun politicians get, quite frankly. So anyway, the bill, House Bill 746 in North Carolina. Next stop will be the House floor for permitless carry. In addition, Fox 6 reporting out of Wisconsin on permitless carry efforts in that state. There was a Senate committee hearing earlier this week. It was an advisory hearing. They didn't take a vote on this, but they were hearing testimony on permitless carry. Senator Dave Craig, Representative Mary Filskowski, the authors of the legislation, note, again, Wisconsin, an open carry state. You can legally, openly carry in Wisconsin, and it hasn't been an issue. All this would do is say that, you know, sometimes it gets cold in Wisconsin. Sometimes it you might want a jacket, like 9 months out of the year. And in that case, those, again, who are legally allowed to own, legally eligible to openly carry, they should be allowed to concealed carry as well. They should be able to put on a jacket without becoming a felon. Senator Lena Taylor, Democrat from Milwaukee, said she voted for legislation to allow concealed carry in Wisconsin in 2011, but that some restrictions are appropriate. She said limits are necessary. Training for me, she said, is one of those lines in the sand. I'm challenged by the concept that you think constitutional rights come unfettered. Well, generally speaking, again, rights don't come with the regulations written into them. And this is not an anti-training bill. You want to talk about training? You want to talk about opposition to training? Okay. Let's talk about the anti-gun activists around the country trying to stop ranges from opening up. Let's talk about what's going on in Ramsey, New Jersey. Let's talk about what's going on in Willowbrook, Illinois. Let's talk about Chicago's alderman and their continued efforts to block a range from opening up in Chicago. You want to talk about training? Let's talk about training. Let's talk about the anti-gun position on training. Because they may say, they may demand training. But they will also demand that the access to that training is as difficult to come by as possible. You know, it's been almost a decade since the Heller decision came down to Washington, D.C. And they decided after the Heller decision, okay, we'll allow you peasants to register your handguns. But got to take a gun safety course. And you can't take it to Washington, D.C. Because we're going to require that you have range time. And we're not going to have a range. How about that? So if you want to register your firearm, great, have at it. Hope you have transportation. Because good luck getting to a range in Maryland or Virginia without transportation. I suppose you could take an Uber, take a cab out. Well, probably not. They don't allow firearms in the Ubers or the cabs. So, again, we'll put as many restrictions in place as possible for you. We'll make it as hard as we possibly can for you to exercise this right. And then we'll proclaim that we're actually just gun safety advocates. Fox 6 in Wisconsin reports that there are currently 328,820 people who have a concealed carry license in the state. It's pretty good. Considering Wisconsin and Illinois, we're battling it out to see who would be the last in the nation with any form of concealed carry laws on the books. And this would not get rid of the concealed carry license in Wisconsin. Any more than permitless carry would get rid of the concealed carry license in North Carolina. It would not. And many individuals in those states would continue to get their concealed carry license. Particularly those who want reciprocity, who would leave the state. We don't have national reciprocity yet, so you would want that concealed carry license, and you'd want the state of Wisconsin, state of North Carolina, to sign as many reciprocity agreements with other states as possible. But again, that's not going to apply to everybody. What we do know is that permitless carry doesn't change who can legally carry. All it says is that if you're legally allowed to own a gun, then you can legally carry that gun. If you're not legally allowed to own the gun, you can't legally carry it. And this doesn't change who is legally allowed to possess a firearm. It just says you don't need a permit to carry one. So in Wisconsin, we've got this legislation that hopefully will be making progress soon. Fox 6 said, they quote Annette Olson of Glenwood City, who, quote, drew guffaws from the opponents of permitless carry when she told the committee that she believes carrying guns is a right handed down from God. She said, we have the ability to openly carry a firearm in Wisconsin without a license or training. Why does covering it up or putting it in my purse any different? I know that every one of you here believes in liberty. Do not legislate against liberty. Democratic Senator Fred Risser challenged Olson, asking if he has a right to feel safe when he's walking down the street. You have a right to feel safe. Well, how could I or you or anybody else challenge your right to feel the way you feel? Yeah, sure, you've got the right to feel safe. You have the right to feel unsafe, too, if you want. I would imagine it depends on the street that you're walking down. I would imagine it would depend on the crime rate in that neighborhood as to whether or not you're going to feel safe or unsafe. But if you have the right to feel safe walking down a street, guess what? Democrats in Milwaukee are violating the constitutional rights of their residents. Mayor Rahm Emanuel is violating the constitutional rights of the citizens of Chicago. The lawmakers in Baltimore are violating the constitutional rights of their residents, because I guarantee you there are hundreds of thousands of people in those cities who don't feel safe in the slightest. And it's not because of a lack of gun control laws, by the way. It's because of the rate of violent crime. Senator Risser, when the resident of Wisconsin, Annette Olson replied the law-abiding people wouldn't hurt him. Senator said he can't tell who's good or bad on the street. Olson said, then worry about everybody. Some of the audience responded, we are. Okay. And will this change? Let's just say for a second. I know we got to take a time out, but let's just say for a second that we got rid of concealed carry in Wisconsin. Now nobody could legally carry. Can't openly carry, can't concealed carry, can't do it with a license, can't do it without a license. There's no more carry. Wisconsin is like Chicago, circa 2009. Wisconsin is like Washington, D.C., circa 2007. You feel safe? If so, why? There's still plenty of crime. There's still plenty of people walking around carrying firearms. They're doing so illegally. Do you feel safe because you got rid of concealed carry? Would you feel safe if you knew that people could no longer legally carry a firearm? And if that would make you feel safe, if you wouldn't look at people as you're walking down the street anymore, if you just automatically feel safe, why? Why? You're not going to be living in a crime-free society. You're not going to be living in a gun-free society. So why would you feel safe if the right to bear arms was taken away? Because it's a right you don't exercise yourself, and so therefore you'll feel better if nobody else can either? Well, your feelings of safety are not contingent on depriving me of my constitutional rights. You want to feel safe? You want to be safe? You want to be safe? Let's go after the violent criminals. We can all agree. Well, we can't all agree. We should all be able to agree that would be the way to go. But nope, apparently they've got a different attitude there in the anti-gun provinces of the state of Wisconsin. All right, we got to take a time out. When we return, James Varney with Real Clear Investigations is going to join us, talking about reforming knife laws around the country. David Harsanyi joins us on the program later in the hour from The Federalist. Stick around. There's much more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
We look at the West, and we see the vast amount of federal land in Nevada and in states like that. Talk about the issue of public lands, and what is the biggest challenge for you at the NRA and for people who are listening and watching right now?
Sure, and it's regional. I mean, public lands issues in Maryland are very different than they are in Montana, as you know, just given the amount of public land that's out there. And most people don't have the ability to hunt on private land. So access to these, you know, this great national treasure that's should be a primary use. Sports shooting, hunting, just shooting in general ought to be a primary use. And in too many areas of the country, it's not. And so what we do is we work, and now that we have Ryan Zinke, who's a sportsman himself, an NRA member, a hunter, at the Department of Interior, that's going to be big for hunting and access issues. But the problem is you have, you know, roads with gates across them. You have, you know, access areas that are locked off where people can't get access to the areas where they hunt. And as people get older, they're not looking to, you know, hike in 15, 20 miles up a mountain, down a mountain, you know, over cliffs and peaks and valleys to try to access their hunting areas. And so access is a huge issue, particularly out west. It's become a bigger and bigger problem under the Obama administration. Now we have an opportunity to revisit some of those issues. And that's an area of real concern and a focus for the National Rifle Association.
All right, so for our listeners, our viewers right now, if you had to give them some homework, let's say you give them two or three things right now they need to be working on to further their needs to help the National Rifle Association, what's the big thing on your plate right now?
Well, the biggest thing, as you mentioned earlier on, is engagement. Like, we can't – it was a great night in November, and we truly helped save the soul of the country. But in a lot of ways, that was just the beginning of our work. Now the hard part starts. And so if we want to see right to carry reciprocity, if we want to see an expansion of Heller and McDonald, if we want to see, you know, our rights respected closer to where they should be, then it's up to us to engage in the democratic process, whether that's through your state legislators or your members of Congress. They need to hear from you. So first and foremost, please continue to support this organization. You know, if your membership has lapsed, please renew your membership. Help us, because this fight is something that we all need to be engaged in, but also just recognize that it's up to us to make our priorities the politicians' priorities. And if we do that, then we're going to be able to effectuate some positive policy changes that have real impact on gun owners and sportsmen all across the country.
They use their media to assassinate real news. They use their schools to teach children that their president is another Hitler. They use their movie stars and singers and comedy shows and award shows to repeat their narrative over and over again. And then they use their ex-president to endorse the resistance, all to make them march, make them protest, make them scream racism and sexism and xenophobia and homophobia, to smash windows, burn cars, shut down interstates and airports, bully and terrorize the law-abiding, until the only option left is for the police to do their jobs and stop the madness. And when that happens, they'll use it as an excuse for their outrage. The only way we stop this, the only way we save our country and our freedom, is to fight this violence of lies with the clenched fist of truth. I'm the National Rifle Association of America, and I'm freedom's safest place.
Nearly all our projects are going to conflict with the natural world, if only in their absurd futility. Their false sense of importance, gravity, and urgency in the face of our upcoming deaths. Only one project embraces death as the absolute that it is. Only one project confronts the absurdity by its very nature. The anti-hunters have imposed a false order on their lives, based on a misconceived perception of the world. Death is evil, they believe, and so the purveyor of death must also be evil. But the world is its own, and it will have itself back.
Welcome back to Cam and Company, right here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. Hopefully you get the chance to go out and explore the great outdoors this weekend. We've got an hour from now, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins from Breitbart joins us. But right now, from Real Clear Investigations, we've got James Varney on the program. James, how are you, sir? Okay, we might be having a little trouble hearing James. We can see James, but we'll see if we can reconnect.
That work better?
And, actually hear. Oh, yes, now we can hear you. How are you, sir?
I'm fine. How about yourself, Kim?
I am great. It's great talking with you. And, I am a big fan of Real Clear Politics. It's a great website. Real Clear Investigations, this is exciting stuff. And you've got a great background as an investigative journalist. And you're looking now at knife laws. I'm curious, James, what made you decide to delve into this topic?
Well, it is something that had come up just before what happened in Texas. We had seen that the group Knife Rights had been having considerable success in a number of different states. And then in the tragedy that happened at the University of Texas on May 1st really sort of prompted the whole thing. And, it was striking, it seemed, that despite what happened, that awful incident on the campus in Austin, and yet the Texas legislature still went forward with it. And we thought that really spoke to the fact that there's broad support for this.
Well, there absolutely is broad support. And I think because we've seen how these knife laws and how they've been written, and some of these laws, as you have found out, have been on the books for decades, and they are causing real trouble for people. Contractors, guys who work construction, are getting arrested for knives that they're purchasing at a hardware store.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, the Legal Aid Society in New York City said they just recently this year found 110 stores in the city that are selling knives that if their clients or you and I had them in our pockets and were stopped for some reason, we could be arrested for it. And so just as you said, you've got instruments that are used by people on the job that are potentially causing criminal problems for them.
And you quote a New York Assemblyman, a Manhattan Democrat, who is sponsoring the knife reform legislation. He said this disproportionately affects people of color. He says you've got cooks, chefs, workers with the Department of Education who use a knife to cut wire. These people are getting arrested. And it's really interesting, James, that gun control is such a divisive political issue. But as you point out, the knife reform efforts, they've been able to sort of avoid the toxic debate about gun control, and you've seen some pretty broad bipartisan support, and you've seen efforts successful in red states and in blue states.
That's exactly right, and you make a great point about the kinds of coalitions that have come together to push this knife reform. You again in New York State, you see something where you have both the NRA, the NAACP, the Legal Aid Society. These are people that aren't normally political allies, and they all feel that absurd is the word that they use to employ this. But just as you say, you've got Democratic governors like Hickenlooper in Colorado, Republican governors in Georgia that are signing this. Illinois is now awaiting the governor's signature there. That's considered, of course, a deep blue state. So it does cross political lines. And people obviously might come to it seeking the reform for different reasons, but they all share the same goal.
So what's happened to the crime rate as these reform efforts have taken place around the country? Have we seen knife-related crime skyrocket as knives become more, quote-unquote, readily available for the general public?
No, actually, there's been a decline. I mean, it's... Obviously, you don't see the same kind of numbers that you do with, say, handguns with knives. And sometimes it's difficult to sort of sort out the FBI statistics because let's say you have a kitchen knife that's used in a domestic dispute that escalates to something tragic like a killing. That would go down as a knife or another sharp instrument. But no, the figures, according to the FBI for homicides, have shown a steady decline in knife-related homicides across the country.
All right, that is good news. And you get into in your piece where these laws came from. I alluded to the fact that a lot of these laws have been on the books for decades. Does this primarily go back to the 40s, the 50s, the anti-switchblade laws? I mean, you talk about West Side Story, Rebel Without a Cause. I mean, is that the era where these laws were really put on the books?
It is. They stem from the Federal Switchblade Act, which, just as you say, was prompted after Hollywood kind of made these things seem like a menace and sort of fixed it in the public imagination, the Jets and the Sharks, of course, like West Side Story, like you said, as a real problem. And some of the state laws then flowed from that. But what happened was, They stayed on the books for, I think, a really long time, and nobody really paid much attention to them. And it was only after Doug Ritter, who heads knife rights, had read a story in the Wall Street Journal talking about assault knives or tactical knives, which he thought was really hyperbolic and didn't do justice to what was actually happening in the United States. That's what triggered him to form Knife Rights as an organization. And then, like you and I spoke about a moment ago, you started to see different people and different political groups come together behind it, because they might have seen it even as a civil rights issue, let alone a Second Amendment kind of issue. But all of those people then started coming together and saying, hey, I didn't even realize that this was on the books. And then the other problem they uncovered was that you didn't have a uniform system of laws. So you might have a local ordinance that was much more restrictive than the state law, and they've tried to get some uniformity to that. Now, that one is not – you still see cases, especially in urban areas like Philadelphia and Chicago, where they might have laws against the length of a blade or the type of knife. And you mentioned that a moment ago, and gravity knives is what we're really talking about. They were both trying to reform laws and to make them uniform.
And as you point out, I mean, those gravity knives, you say a Village Voice analysis in 2014 found that the prohibition in New York City had resulted in 60,000 prosecutions in the state over the past 10 years. And you say, you know, despite the broad coalition of people who are engaged in these efforts to reform the laws, not everybody's on board with this, right? In New York State, you talk about Governor Andrew Cuomo, Manhattan DA Cyrus Vance Jr. You say that Vance's office told you that the laws that are in place are good ones and insisted that innocent parties aren't prosecuted. This doesn't happen. The only people who are prosecuted, James, are violent criminals who shouldn't be carrying these knives in the first place. That's what they say.
That's what they say, and it doesn't appear to be factually accurate. I think what you just said is another great example of what we're talking about. I mean, the Village Voice and the NRA aren't usually associated together. I would think that that's an outlet that's generally hostile to the Second Amendment. And yet, just like you said, you've got pillars of the Democratic establishment in New York, Governor Andrew Cuomo and Cy Vance Jr., who's the district attorney in Manhattan, and by the way, aren't normally considered to be the best of friends politically. But they are the two that are standing in the way of this. The lower level in the assembly just passed court's bill again. I think that was the fourth time. And the last time it went to the Senate, it passed 62-1. So that's not a close call. They think that they've addressed the issues that Cuomo and court have, but this looks to be something where the prosecutors and the cops, A, they like the discretion that it gives them. It seems to be an easy conviction for them. And then B, you know how controversial the stop and frisk policies were with the NYPD and how that triggered its own set of court battles. According to the Voice analysis, which was done about 3 years ago, that was really making up a high percentage of the arrests under the stop and frisk was knives. And it included, as you said at the outset of your segment here, you had people that worked on Broadway. You had people that worked for the education department and electricians that of course would have knives as part of their day-to-day job. And they were getting arrested. And, you know, you get arrested in a place like New York City, it may be 48 hours or longer before you even get before an arraignment, unless you get ROR'd. So this is a serious problem.
Absolutely it is. And I really, again, I appreciate you coming on the program to talk about it. I appreciate you writing about this, James. And I hope that we can have you on again in the future, sir. Thanks very much for joining us today.
Happy to do it, Cam, anytime.
James Varney joining us from Real Clear Investigations on Twitter at RC Investigates, realclearinvestigations.com. Again, I think this is really exciting stuff. Real Clear Politics, you know, they have been a great aggregator site. You want the latest polls? I go to Real Clear Politics because they've got all their polls lined up. You want, you know, the latest commentary? Boy, you can find it. They aggregate, you know, so many columnists, so many opinion writers. It's a great resource. But now to do this original reporting and this investigative reporting, I love it. Love it. So RC Investigates on Twitter. David Harsanyi at The Federalist is going to join us here in just a minute or two. Says that Democrats have lost on climate change, and it's their own fault. It's apparently not Russian hacking. It's not misogyny. It's all of the excuses that Hillary Clinton offers. Not DNC data. Nope. It's maybe just the way they're going about it. Stick around. We've got more Cam and Company coming up right after this.
Two of my favorite people are here, the Girls with Guns, Jen and Narissa. So this is kind of a new thing, right? I mean, not the Girls with Guns clothing, but the expansion, how big you all have gotten that now you've got your booth space. You were at SHOT Show with your booth space, and this is a big step for you all
as
a company.
Our very first time having a booth at SHOT Show, and we were so excited. We feel so blessed to be able to grow from our garage to where we are today.
Can you talk about how you did that? Because this is, you know, look, I think it's a great entrepreneurial story, and I know that there are people out there right now who say, I've got an idea, but I don't know how to take it from in my head to end it up right here. So how do you do that?
Well, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. No, that just... Narissa and I have really put in a ton of hours. I mean, for the last 8 years, we've given up parts of our life, our family time, and really, I mean, we've just stuck together. And I think that's the main thing is drive, ambition, and knowing what you want and seeing that end goal. And we aren't there yet. We're in the teenage stages of our company, and I just feel like we're ready to take on the world and really stand up for our Second Amendment rights and our hunting rights and make our voices heard as women in the outdoor industry.
So you all have more plans to come. You want to keep getting bigger, keep growing.
I think there's so much opportunities for our brand, you know, from garage to where we are today. And, you know, just expanding with the hunting line and, you know, we have some future plans of... Wink, wink. Can't really say it yet, but stay tuned.
Okay.
We can't tell you that yet.
All
but
right.
Maybe next year we'll have a quick chat about it.
Can we get an exclusive when you all are ready to reveal this?
I would love that. Okay. I would love that. It's
right.
It's going to be very special, and I think you'll love it, too.
Okay.
And
so,
it has to do with, well.
Come on.
We did give a little quick sneak peek to Carrie Lightfoot with the well-armed woman. So.
Okay, I'll have to go bug her then. Spill the beans, Carrie. Let me know what's going on. So what is the mission of Girls with Guns? What do your customers want from you, and why do your customers come to you?
You know what I really feel like Narissa and I stand for, which means Girls with Guns stands for, is just empowering women in every state, because it's not just hunting. It's not just about our Second Amendment rights. It's about just sticking together as women and being strong and really getting out there. Whether you're looking at our new tank tops, where we're backing the LEOs, Back the Blue, that was just an idea from our digital marketing manager, whose husband is an LEO. And we are really working on just getting out there in our community and doing as much as we can to support every different facet of it with our Second Amendment right. Whether it's hunting, guns, legislator, whatever we can do, and that's where we're going to be focusing.
Do you think that your customer base are they activists? Are they involved in the Second Amendment, or is this? Because I imagine you want them to be. You don't want this just to be a fashion statement. You want this to be a statement of principle here.
Yeah, I would say so. And it was Well, right now we're launching a Second Amendment collection here. And, you know, it's pretty amazing when you do see some of our customers and they're coming by and they saying, I am the Second Amendment. And to see them walking by, I know that they're taking that stance and they're showing it and they're wearing it proudly. And it just makes my heart so happy to see that.
That is fantastic. You know, I got to ask, too, we've seen some gun shaming, I think, when it comes to women. We've got anti-gun activists who say, don't own a gun, ladies, right? It's gonna be make your life more dangerous. You're going to be miserable. Don't own a gun. At the same time, they say they're not anti-gun. They're just in favor of gun safety, right? But it is this attitude of, well, the only way to be safe is to not own a firearm. Clearly, there are more and more women who are rejecting that argument. Are you hearing from a lot of new gun owners?
Absolutely, and that's actually one of our focuses this year, is getting out and mentoring our youth, and we've been doing that for years already. Teaching them proper gun handling is where it's at. It's about firearm safety. It's not about not owning a gun. That is our right. It is our Second Amendment right, and I carry a firearm every day. I have my concealed carry permit. It's my Ruger 380 LCP, and it's been on me for 6 years, and it is something that I firmly believe in, my right to defend myself if ever needed, and I hope I never have to use that. I'm 5 foot tall. If I was stuck in a dark alley with somebody much bigger than me, I wouldn't have a choice if they were trying to attack me or defending my home, and that is my right, and I've always felt very strongly about that from the time I was a kid. That's how I was raised, and I just think that we stand up for that and teaching women the right way to handle firearms, and so that they're not afraid of them. That's what we're about.
Welcome back. Thanks again for being a part of this edition of Cam and Company on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125, iHeartRadio, iTunes. We got you covered. AWR Hawkins of Breitbart, Tony Katz coming up next hour. Right now, David Harsanyi, senior editor at The Federalist, is with us on the program. David, how are you today?
I'm doing well. Thank you.
You bet. Democrats have lost on climate change, and it's their own fault, you say. It's not. Is it the fault of the DNC data folks, David? Is that where we can lay the blame?
Typically, I blame them a little bit, but I think it's even bigger than that. I think it's sort of a 20-year or 30-year mistake, they calculated wrong when they made science into something that was so ideological, and I think that the pushback on that has resulted in where we are now, which is them losing on climate change most of the time.
You say whenever the U.S. failed to adopt climate change policy favored by the left, the advocates like to point to polls that allegedly illustrate a vast majority of Americans support, quote, fighting climate change or, quote, reducing carbon emissions or, quote, believe in global warming. We often see this with the anti-gun side, too. They'll put out polls showing 80% of Americans want stronger gun laws. 80% of Americans want background checks. And they don't actually explain to those 80% of Americans the specific policy that they're calling for. You say it's a vague, feel-good moral declaration that's the equivalent of voters saying that they're in favor of reducing poverty or helping children. And you say the more useful question is, what are you willing to do, right? What, are you willing to give up one of your cars? Are you willing to go without electricity for a couple of days, rolling brownouts? I mean, what? Yeah, we want to see the world. Look, we all want to see a utopia here. We want to see heaven on earth. But what are you willing to give up to try to get that?
Right, and obviously when you look at how people act, which is the sort of ultimate way to measure what people are willing to do, they're not willing to do very much at all. I mean, you know, I saw a poll months ago, but that fewer people are carpooling now than 20 years ago, you know, to work. After all the sort of, you know, everyone building these lanes for people to carpool and so on. So I think, they want other people to do things for them. They want to have solar panels that are paid for by other people, but I don't think they want to themselves get involved. And listen, we understand why. You know, we live a certain lifestyle, and it's difficult to give up. But then let's not pretend. Then let's deal with reality, which I don't think they've done.
So in terms of, you know, turning a science into frankly, a catchphrase, David, right? I mean, that's the sad thing is that the people who shout science often couldn't tell you much about the science involving climate change, right? The most that they could get, generally speaking, would be a talking point of, well, the vast majority of scientists believe it's real, it's happening right now, we've got to do whatever they say to stop it. And that's about as deep as they get when it comes to science.
Right. They take a giant jump, though, and conflate things. So they say science, and then all of a sudden they say that all scientists believe the most, you know, the end of world predictions that Al Gore comes up with, or they talk about science, and all of a sudden, if you don't agree with the policy prescription they've come up with, then you don't believe in science. Well, I actually believe in global warming. I'm not as worried about it because I don't think there's much we can do, and I also think that the policies that progressives mostly have come up with over the last 10 years are more harmful than global warming would be. So that's no longer about science. It's about policy. They want to pretend that all of that's just science, but it's not. There is no, listen, there's no, you know, carbon credits or cap, you know, cap and trade and things of that nature. That's not science. It's policy. Mm-hmm. And, I think you can make an economic argument against it, even if global warming is as true as they say.
You know, you make a really good point about the policy versus the ideology, because ultimately that's what it does boil down to. And we were talking about this actually earlier today, because today is the Wear Orange Day for the anti-gun groups. And there's a lot of, you know, think pieces and opinion pieces. And Vogue's got an interview with Shannon Watts. And they're so light on actual policies, right? It's all
right.
Well, get involved. And, you know, go local, right, and do something. But they don't actually say, like, here's what we do. The one policy that they talked about was Maryland in 2013 passing these gun control laws. Vogue didn't mention the fact that Baltimore, Maryland right now is on pace for a record high number of homicides after these gun control laws were passed 4 years ago. That's the difference between ideology and policy, right? If it's all about the ideology, then you're willing to ignore the results of whatever policies you manage to put in place if they don't comport with your ideology.
Right. So on climate change, why aren't we building tons of nuclear power plants? I mean, if we really want to change things, why are we banning fracking in New York or whatever? It's because they really mean let's do these policies that we like, not let's do what's best or let's work together and come up with something we all like or whatever. And with gun control, it's a little bit more specific only because the gun itself is their problem. Whereas in climate change, you know, everything is the problem. Literally, if you want to you know, make laws that dictate how we, you know, emit carbon, you essentially can dictate anything. So that's what makes it dangerous in a different way. And, you know, but definitely it's the same sort of thinking where the actual outcomes don't matter. It's the sort of morality of what you're doing and to feel good about what you're doing and to always be moving forward in your mind, not actually change things in a positive way.
Yeah, I would listen, and you get into this too, the idea that you say when people who hop on planes every other day lecture people about living more prudently, they react accordingly. Like, I'll think to myself, okay, Hollywood really is worried about climate change when they cancel the Cannes Film Festival. I mean, I don't want to hear celebrities lecture me about my carbon footprint when they're, you know, jetting halfway around the globe to go watch a movie.
And doesn't it indicate that they're not really serious about it? Meaning, if I thought the world was coming to an end, I would not get on a plane every other day. I would not go to Paris to have these meetings. I'd Skype it, you know? If they really believe these things were true, you know, why don't they act in a way that's more responsible? So I don't believe that they believe it, even if it were true, and I don't like to be lectured, even though I get that it's just a few reporters are on planes and all of that, and it's a bigger problem. But the bottom line is it's being lectured by people who are hypocrites. It's just, as a human being, I find that offensive, even if it doesn't matter policy-wise.
And as you say, it undercuts the argument, right?
Yeah.
I mean, at the end of the day, if this is the argument that you're making, well, don't tell other people how their lives are going to have to change. Let's see you change your life.
Right. And I also mentioned that, you know, this idea, you know, I talk about trade-offs, and obviously most people understand what that means. But I think that a lot of people, even who don't understand economic trade-offs, intuitively get what that's about. That's why we don't build nuclear power plants, because there are other issues at stake. That's why some people are against fracking, because it's not that simple. But then when you make the same argument, they just call you a denier. You're not allowed to talk about trade-offs. You're not allowed to talk about economic policy. What they're really trying to do is just circumvent the debate, which is what they typically do. So I think that's why they're losing, because most people aren't willing to go along with that. Maybe they are in a poll, but I don't think in real life they are.
David Harsanyi, a senior editor at The Federalist. Listen, thank you as always, sir, for coming on the program. It's good talking with you today.
Always fun. Thank you.
You bet. We'll do it again soon. David Harsanyi here, Dr. A.W. Hawkins of Breitbart, Tony Katz from WIBC coming up on the program. We also have at the top of the hour today's hero of the day, our deal of the day, and our good guy of the day. In the couple of minutes we have left this hour, The Hill newspaper in Washington, D.C., gun lobby seeks to calm fears about silencers. Mm-hmm. Educate people on what suppressors and silencers really are. And the Hill talks about the recent event the NRA had at its range, American Silencer Association, NSSF, all engaged in education outreach efforts. But the anti-gun groups, they don't like this. Shanna Watts from Moms Demand Action doesn't even like the term suppressor. Nope. The same crowd that came up with the meaningless phrase assault weapon doesn't like the use of the word suppressor. Go figure that. Shanna Watts says it's all semantics. Focusing on the name distracts people from the real conversation, she said. They did the same thing with the debate over whether to use the term assault rifles or semi-automatic rifles. And then the whole conversation shifted to, what are we going to call these things? They want to get into semantics about the language so we don't talk about how dangerous they are. Actually, it was gun control groups who tried to make semi-automatic rifles sound more dangerous by calling them, quote-unquote, assault weapons. But, yeah, I guess we're just reinventing history now over on the gun control side. Now it's the gun owners who couldn't figure out what to call semi-automatic firearms, as opposed to the gun control advocates who are trying to come up with the scariest word to use. So they just created one. And again, if there was a reporter at The Hill, who was the reporter for this story? Tim Devaney. No offense to Tim Devaney, but I'm guessing Tim doesn't know a whole lot about the gun issue. Guessing he doesn't have a whole lot of background, because I would have. Ask Shanna Watts, okay, well, let's talk about semantics then. And I would have asked Shanna Watts a really simple question. What is a quote-unquote assault weapon? Can you define it for me? What is it? Because if Shanna Watts wants to talk about semantics, let's talk about the fact that that phrase, dreamt up by the gun control activists, means something entirely different depending on what state of the union you're in. California has got its own definition of what a quote-unquote assault weapon is. New York has a different one. Maryland has a different one. Massachusetts had one on the books and then suddenly decided that their definition was greatly expanded after 18 years of having a quote-unquote assault weapons ban on the books. Yeah, let's talk about the semantics of the gun control movement. Now, if you want to talk about suppressors themselves, again, the gun control activists out there are talking about how dangerous suppressors are. Why would they be suppressor, or why would they be dangerous? Because they stop a gun from being as loud as it could be. And this apparently is now an official talking point of the anti-gun movement, that guns have to be as loud as possible. Yeah. As The Hill's Tim Devaney writes, a typical gunshot can be louder than 160 decibels. The NRA claims suppressors can reduce the sound by more than 30 decibels. That brings it just below the hearing danger level. But gunfire masked by silencers is far from silent, the NRA argues. Tim Devaney says, they point out, still louder than jackhammers and ambulance sirens. Gun control groups, in turn, raise concerns about humanizing silencers by comparing them to regular sounds. What? Again, what? Humanizing silencers by comparing them to... Maybe he meant normalizing silencers. Like, you can't normalize suppressors. Like, you can't normalize Trump. Erica Soto Lamb, spokesperson for Everytown for Gun Safety, says, I don't think it matters because lawnmowers aren't responsible for the deaths of about 90 Americans each day. What? Again, what? We're talking about the sound level of a firearm. Erica Soto Lamb with the Everytown, again, supposedly not the anti-gun group that they we think they are, says, well, no, but lawnmowers aren't killing people. All right, stick around. Hour three of Cam and Company. Much more logical than that story coming up next.
Citizenry makes for a stronger country, a stronger society, a safer society.
And we prepare for so much that leads up to pulling the trigger. Are you prepared to deal with what happens after?
It's as complete a package as we could possibly have put together. We want to give someone the tools so that they can make good decisions in a very stressful, probably the most stressful situation that they'll ever encounter.
Having the NRA actually put together standardized concealed carry training and putting the resources behind it, you know, says quite a bit.
Everybody involved has that real world experience, has the education, has the understanding.
You know that this training is safe and it will work.
From the tactical, we're ready up.
It's far easier than anyone understands for an innocent person to be convicted of a crime.
We live in a litigious society. You need an attorney that understands what you've gone through, that understands the legal parameters of this situation, and is going to be able to not just adequately defend your rights, but to defend your rights from the tyranny of restrictions that prevent you from being able to defend yourself. Protect yourself. Get Carry Guard.
Call 911, wait for the law enforcement to show up, and then call the emergency hotline on the back of their NRA Carry Guard membership card that's available 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year to all NRA Carry Guard members.
When we're talking about something like the NRA, we're talking about the largest civil rights organization in the country.
There is no other entity that has the expertise, the resources, the connections, the philosophy, and the infrastructure.
There is no other organization in the United States of America that can do what NRA has done with Carry Guard. There is no organization that gives you that gold standard protection and assurance.
If I find myself in a position where I had to use my gun to defend my life, I can tell you right now, I'm going to be glad that I had the Carry Guard.
In America since 1949. Family owned and operated. Legendary performance. This is Hornady.
Wild turkey.
venison stew, roasted pheasant, rabbit risotto. The chemical-free, just-picked ingredients and the absence of antibiotics in the freshest of meats are the essence of today's farm-to-table food culture. But hunters have been eating this way for centuries. This is their table, and this is their farm. Trust the hunter in your blood.
You're watching NRA TV with Cam Edwards.
Welcome back. Hour three of Cam and Company, fueled by Hornady. It starts right this second here on NRA TV. SiriusX and Patriot 125 and more. We've got Tony Katz from WIBC. He's going to join us in just a little bit. Also coming up here in about 20 minutes or so, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart joins us talking about some of the big stories of the day and of the week. Right now, though, let's get to our hero of the day, brought to you by Adcore Defense, deal of the day. Good guy as well. Today's hero of the day from the Moultrie Observer in Moultrie, Georgia. Macy Lott lives in Omega, Georgia. And it was just after midnight Wednesday morning when Macy got a knock on her door. There was a stranger there, a woman. And the woman told Macy that her husband was on the ground having a heart attack. Macy hadn't seen this woman before, didn't know what was going on. Macy Lott told the stranger, okay, I'll call 911 for you. And then she said, I have a gun. Just to let this stranger know, and the guy laying on the ground there in her yard, I have a gun, I'll call 911, but I can defend myself, just so you know. As it turns out, apparently the presence of that firearm in the hand of Macy Lott helped this guy recover from his heart attack. It's amazing, because once this guy on the ground in front of Macy Lott's house heard that she had a gun, he said, let's get in the car and get out of here. And the woman who had just knocked on Macy's door, help me, my husband's having a heart attack, she left. And the guy who was there on the ground, supposedly having the heart attack, he got in the car, drove off, didn't even wait for 911, didn't even wait for the paramedics to come and check him out. That's amazing. Now, maybe, just maybe, Macy Lott was going to be the victim of a crime and was not simply going to be a good Samaritan helping a heart attack victim. She is today's hero of the day. Macy Lott in Omega, Georgia. Now, our deal of the day. I've got two for you. One from NJ.com. Felon in Jersey City. Going before a judge this week. Taylor Stackhouse is his name. Taylor is 35 years old. Taylor was facing 4 years in prison. Taylor is not going to prison. Taylor was instead sentenced to drug court probation, where he will have a chance to get clean. He told a judge yesterday morning, I think I need drug court because I ain't got nothing left. He's already on probation right now. He said it would probably be easier to just serve a state prison sentence, but he wanted help. It was March of this year when Mr. Stackhouse pleaded guilty to burglary, unlawful taking of a means of conveyance, unlawful possession of an imitation firearm, as well as drug possession. 18 convictions in Taylor Stackhouse's history. He's 35. He's got 18 previous convictions. And the prosecutor said, look, we've sent him to prison. Clearly, that doesn't work. Actually, that was the judge who said that. Said, he's already served prison time. Quote, that clearly didn't work. The only thing that has worked for a period of time was drug court. Yeah, Taylor Stackhouse has been in drug court before, too. And it may have worked for a time. Clearly, it did not have a permanent effect. And I would say, I mean, honestly, if that's the rationale of the judge, well, putting Taylor Stackhouse behind bars worked for a period of time, too, because while he was behind bars, he wasn't committing crimes. So, yeah, that did have an effect. He got out, and he went on to commit more crimes, kind of like the last time he went to drug court, completed it, and went back to a life of crime. Kind of seems like either or. The problem is that Taylor Stackhouse isn't getting his act together after 18 convictions, after prison time, after drug court. That seems to be the issue here. But the assistant prosecutor there in Hudson County, New Jersey, Andrea Hellenhausen, told the judge that Stackhouse's probation officer felt drug court was a good option for the defendant. The prosecutor agreed. But the judge did say, I can assure you, if you do commit a crime when you're on this program, sir, you will be subject to the maximum sentence the court can give you. You get involved in the criminal justice system when you're on this drug court probation. Be prepared to pay some consequences. 18 convictions. Kind of sounds like consequences, maybe something lacking in Mr. Stackhouse's previous run-ins with the law. Our second deal of the day from the Baltimore Sun. I already told you, Baltimore right now, record high number of homicides. That's what they're on pace for. They ended May with more than 140 homicides, first time in the city's history that that has happened, even going back to the bad old days of the 1990s. This is the first time that that's happened. Things are worse in Baltimore now than they were portrayed on the wire 15 years ago. And Kevin Rector of the Baltimore Sun reports that robbery, assault, and other charges have been filed against two teenagers involved in the crash of a carjacked vehicle that left a Baltimore police detective injured on Tuesday. 18-year-old Deshaun Hartwell and an unidentified 16-year-old boy have both been charged with armed robbery, first and second degree assault, theft, and possession of stolen property in relation to the crash and robbery that happened on Tuesday. It was about 10 o'clock Tuesday morning. The suspects exit a black SUV and demand a 17-year-old victim give them his cell phone. He refused. They then assaulted him, took his phone, fled in the same SUV. The crash occurred less than an hour later as the teens allegedly attempted to flee from a uniformed police officer in northeast Baltimore in the same SUV used in the robbery. Police say that the teens were suspects in a string of robberies and burglaries and at least one carjacking in the 24 hours prior to them crashing that SUV. The Baltimore detective in an unmarked car in plain clothes. He was stepping out of his vehicle when the crash occurred. He injured his ankle. Thankfully, it was not a serious injury. After the crash, the two suspects then bail out, captured during foot chases. Baltimore Sun reports various electronics and other items stolen, and at least two of the previous burglaries were found in the vehicle that they were driving. The SUV had been stolen, of course, in a carjacking on Monday of this week in Baltimore. And police say the two teens are, quote, suspected to be involved in several other incidents in northeast Baltimore. Detectives are working to identify other juveniles. And the older of the two suspects, 18-year-old Deshaun Hartwell, well, guess what? No stranger to the criminal justice system at the ripe old age of 18. He is currently on probation for the unlawful taking of a vehicle in February of this year, just a few months ago. He was found guilty in March. He received a suspended 3-year prison term, was ordered to pay $250 in restitution, and was placed on probation through 2020. Well, that appears not to have had much of an effect on Mr. Hartwell, who now faces a total of 12 charges, many of them felonies, there in Baltimore. He is our second deal of the day. Our good guy today from NBC, Washington, D.C., Alexandria, Virginia, home of the mothership, a good Samaritan coming to the aid of a woman in Alexandria, Wendy Irving, had just ordered her lunch at Giuliano's Pizzeria on Richmond Avenue in Alexandria when she saw a car pull up outside. She's standing there outside the restaurant. She sees this car just, you know, peel through the parking lot. Driver gets out. He drags a woman out of the car who appears to be unconscious and leaves her there. Wendy Irving said he stopped. He jumped out, and I was like, oh, my God, what's he doing? And so he jumped out, and he ran around to the passenger side. He opened the back door, and he pulled. It was a body. It was a lady out of the car and dropped her on the ground. And then he ran, and he jumped back in the car, and he took off. Well, Wendy Irving said, I saw the lady. I got down on the ground. I felt her neck. There was no pulse. I felt her wrist. There was no pulse. So I immediately started doing the chest compressions, and she wasn't moving. It wasn't looking good. And so I just kept doing it, and she choked, and I was like, oh, my God, oh, my God. EMTs arrived. Woman was breathing by the time they got there. An officer thanked Irving, told her she saved the woman's life. Wendy Irving's coworker, LaJuan Croswell, said things like this go unnoticed, and I thought it was important to share. It's not all bad. There are still genuinely good people out here with concern and compassion for complete strangers. Sounds like LaJuan Croswell ended up alerting the media to this story. Wendy Irving didn't do it. Police are still investigating the incident, but Wendy Irving, who works in Alexandria, Virginia, at the Department of Recreation, Parks, and Cultural Activities, in the right place at the right time, and willing and able to do the right thing, saving a life. Thank you, Wendy, for being one of the many, many good guys out there. Still no word. Karen, have you heard what happened to the woman? Have you seen any follow-up stories there locally?
This is the first I'd heard the story, so no. I will look up to see if there's any follow-up. And there's lots of local papers here, lots of local feeds. But I haven't seen the story yet.
Yeah, well, there you go. A life-saving moment just miles away from the mothership there in Alexandria. All right, still to come, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins joins us from Breitbart, Tony Katz from WIBC. And you know, we've been talking about Baltimore so much today because of the record high homicide rate right there. Yeah, the deals of the day. One of the things that they're doing in Baltimore is they're doing this mass surveillance. There's a story at the Miami Herald today. To fight crime, Miami-Dade may deploy blanket surveillance from the air. Talk about sending a surveillance plane in the skies above Miami, and basically monitoring the city, not necessarily in real time, but recording from the air what's taking place on the ground. And then when there is a crime, police will be able to go and take that footage and trace back supposedly where that individual came from, where that individual who may be suspected of crime went to after the crime. Lieutenant Juan Villalba Jr. says it's kind of like a DVR. He says this will allow us to go back and look at what happened. Miami Herald says it's already used in Baltimore. The technology lets police pull footage after a crime occurs and try to recreate where the perpetrators came from on their way to the scene and where they fled to afterward. If this is in place in Baltimore, and it is, although there's discussion in Baltimore whether or not to continue doing this, it doesn't seem to have had an effect on the crime rate in Baltimore. It should be noted, again, dealing with a record high number of homicides this year. Miami Herald says it has helped spark a national debate on civil liberties as it pushes the edge of what is possible now in mass surveillance. The ACLU of Florida said in a statement this week, that this is not the way to adopt public policy. No system of surveillance will be put into place until it is first established that there is a need, which this system addresses, and that there are protections in place for the privacy of the people of Miami-Dade County. Until these protections for the rights and privacy of the people of Miami-Dade County are put into place, the grant request, they say, should be withdrawn. Meanwhile, the mayor of Miami-Dade, Carlos Jimenez, says, you have no expectation of privacy when you walk outside. I, the mayor said, have no expectation of privacy in my backyard. I'm curious. Do you agree? Do you agree with the mayor that when you step outside that you have no expectation of privacy? Not even on your person? mean, would the mayor really believe that? You walk outside, and, yeah, we can stop you and search you for whatever. You don't have any expectation of privacy. You're on a public street. Or even worse, you have no expectation of privacy in your backyard. Well, here's the thing. If I, depending on my backyard, I may or may not have an expectation of privacy. When I lived in Northern Virginia, I could step out onto my tiny postage stamp size backyard, and I could count about 14 houses that I could see from my backyard. No, I didn't have much of an expectation of privacy in my backyard. Now, I live on a farm. I have an expectation of privacy in my backyard. Yeah, every now and then I'll see a helicopter fly overhead. We've got the life flight, and we've got a lot of activity at one of the forts in Blackstone, Virginia. Every now and then you see an airplane fly overhead. We got the Farmville Airport a few miles away. But generally speaking, no, I have an expectation of privacy in my backyard. And more importantly, you do have an expectation that you're not being... It's one thing to say, all right, you know what, I don't have an expectation of privacy because I can see my neighbor and my neighbor can see me. It's another thing to say, because my neighbor can see me, my government can spy on me by having an airplane flying overhead 8 to 12 hours a day, recording everything taking place on the ground. Wee bit of a difference, don't you think, between, my neighbor can see into my backyard, and, yeah, Big Brother is flying the friendly skies up there and recording everything that's happening 15,000 feet below. The Miami Herald says a surveillance plane flying 25,000 feet in the air would need to focus its cameras on a small piece of Miami-Dade at any one time to capture footage within its 32-mile viewing field. So they can see 32 miles, but they need to zoom in on certain locations. They say that's likely to put some of Miami-Dade's poorest neighborhoods under heavy surveillance while more affluent areas are ignored. County police plan to deploy the surveillance in high-crime areas, which tend to be neighborhoods with lower incomes. The mayor says, we're going to have to focus the technology on the areas and neighborhoods that the statistics show are experiencing high crime rates. So if you live, again, in a high-crime neighborhood, you have apparently even less of an expectation of privacy than you do if you're living in a gated community. It's I think before they do this, there are those civil liberties concerns. I've got some civil liberty concerns about this. But what's the usefulness of this? Well, I mean, what's been the impact? Say Baltimore is doing this. Yeah, and Baltimore might not be doing this. Baltimore's been talking about pulling out because of the concerns. And at the same time, right alongside these civil liberties concerns, there is the concern of, okay, is this doing anything? Is this effective? Is this helping to solve crimes? Is this bringing down the crime rate? Because I got to tell you, I wouldn't be looking to Baltimore right now as evidence that, well, look, they're doing it, so we should do it too. Not when the city's murder rate is at an historically high level. To me, Baltimore should be the one looking around at cities and localities that have seen their crime rates drop and say, what are they doing there? Not the other way around. All right, we got to take a timeout. When we return, Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins joins us from Breitbart. We've got more of the day's top story straight ahead, so stick around. More Cam and Company's coming up right after this.
Here at the Congressional Shootout with Congressman Rob Whitman of Virginia. Tell me why people, us in Northern Virginia, should get the hell out of there and come visit you guys.
Well, down on the Northern Neck where I live is really sportsman's paradise. If you like hunting, a great place to be. Lots of great shooting sports opportunities down there as well as fishing. So a great, great area. I'm blessed to live there. Live in the little tiny town of Montrose, population 350, can walk out my back door and hear the turkeys gobbling and hear the wood ducks and the geese fly over back to roost in the pond behind the house. So it's a great, great place. I'm blessed to live there and get to travel home every evening from D.C. there.
Yeah, you're a lucky man. You got to get out of D.C. You know, so we've seen these stories recently, Congressman, these very vitriolic, angry town halls. You talk about living in your town where people have, I'm sure, direct access to you. Saw one video yesterday. You know, someone attacked a congressman, grabbed his collar. It's getting really ugly, sir. What have you seen?
You know, we've tried to make sure we're engaging folks in ways that are most productive to have a civil conversation. It becomes very difficult, I think, if you have these large town halls. We've met with a lot of these groups that obviously have different viewpoints on things, but we meet with them in a smaller context, smaller groups, to where we can actually have a civil conversation back and forth. It is disturbing when you see that, and I think all of us want to have those civil dialogues with folks, but it is disturbing if they get to a point where people are either hollering and screaming to where others can't talk or listen, and then two, if they want to act out in those situations. So I just think people need to take a breath. We understand there's some difference of opinion out there, but you know, we're all about making sure that our process works and having a civil discourse. No matter where you are, how passionate you are about your issues, I think it's all about having that civil discourse in this nation. And, you know, what we've done is to try to look at ways so we can make sure we encourage that and assure that even if people are passionate about what they talk about, that we can do it in a way that's productive, where we're respectful of everybody's viewpoint, and make sure, too, that it's not about volume, it's about substance.
Here at the NRA annual meeting, not too far away from the NRA Country Soundstage. You might hear some music in the background, and this is music to gun owners' ears right here. This is a firearms-friendly credit card processing. Eric, where have you been all our lives?
We've actually been with the NRA for quite a while, so maybe we're not doing a good enough job of getting the message out there, so apologies there. So
we hear more and more, though, about firearm companies, whether they're gun stores, they make accessories, they don't even make firearms, but all of a sudden, now they're being told by their bank, sorry, we don't want to do business with you anymore. No, we don't want to have anything to do with you. Whether it's the money going in or the money being processed,
right.
The industry is, you know, they're definitely dealing with this, and you guys are a solution.
Absolutely, absolutely. The industry suffered from what was called Operation Choke Point for a while, where it was federal regulations on banking and credit card processing. So what we do is we provide 100% firearm-friendly credit card processing, and we educate folks how to take payment for a firearm lawfully and correctly, and also save money and support the NRA in the process.
Okay, so are you for the business, are you for the consumer, are you for both?
Both. We provide business services, so anyone who's taking a payment for a merchant, you know, credit card, as far as a firearm piece, we would provide that service for them.
Okay, fantastic. And is the company growing? I mean, is this...
Absolutely, absolutely. We have 45,000 merchants currently on the books. I believe 20,000 of them are with the NRA presently. So it's growing every day. We have a great retention rate. Folks stay with us, and the endorsement of the NRA as well as other organizations in the firearm space help that as well.
All right, so how can folks find out more about Clearant?
They can go to Clearant's website at www.clearant.com, or they can go to the NRABA.org, and underneath the member services section, you'll find us listed there as well.
Awesome. Again, part of the NRA Business Alliance, Clearant Intelligent Processing. Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125. We have our friend A.W.R. Hawkins from Breitbart with us on the program right now. Obama drinks orange cup to support gun control campaign, among the stories A.W.R. has with us today. Dr. Hawkins, how are you, sir?
I'm doing great. How are you doing?
I am fantastic. Oh, man, you look like you are just out in the middle of God's country right now.
Right, I'm out in the middle of West Texas. Literally, we're gonna shoot a couple of Daniel Defense rifles, and I'm gonna shoot my H&K VP40, which is my personal carry gun. I absolutely adore that gun. Gonna shoot it and just wreak havoc as much as possible when you're shooting with a handgun at a bunch of tin cans that you just for no explainable reason are angry at. And so I'm gonna let all of my frustration out of those cans. I'm gonna have a little fun.
Good for you. I'm a little jealous there. As you write, today is National Gun Violence Awareness Day. It is also National Donut Day, I believe. If you want to get a donut, if you want more gun control laws, you're supposed to wear orange, or I guess just hold something orange, anything orange. Hold an orange, maybe, and that would be enough, right, to show your support. Because you write that never one to miss out on the opportunity to push a curtailment of Second Amendment rights, Barack Obama took to Twitter to show his solidarity with the gun control cause, holding an orange coffee cup and tweeting on this National Gun Violence Awareness Day, let your voice be heard and show your commitment to reducing gun violence. You know, Dr. Hawkins, it strikes me that the people who we really need to see that commitment from are the people who are actually
causing violent crime, right? If you're not out there committing violent crime with a gun or a knife or a hammer or whatever, you really don't need to show your commitment to reducing gun violence because you're not creating any. We need to see that commitment to reducing gun violence from the people who are actually causing such harm in our communities.
I agree 100%. You know, the people causing that are not the people at gun shows. They're not the people at the local gun store. They're not the people I'll shoot with today, one of whom is a Texas state trooper. They're not those people. They're not your mom and pop, your grandma and grandpa. They are the people in gang-related violence and street crime. We know where they live in Chicago and Baltimore and other cities. And the officials refuse to go after them or refuse to go after them with any real ramifications for what they've done. So they have no real encouragement to quit with the behavior that they're carrying out. And then you have these other people, as you say, they come on the back of that and they want to push gun control as if you and I need more gun control because of what the gang members are doing in Chicago. That's not how I'm acting. That's not how you're acting. That's how they're acting. So go after them. You know, this is really a day, in my opinion, where it's kind of like country club day for the gun controllers. Obama doesn't really have to wear orange. He just holds an orange cup. He's wearing a gray suit. Gray or blue, but he's wearing a gray or blue suit. He just holds an orange cup and he's in. Everybody claps, and celebrity after celebrity will do that, and no one will really handle the problem. And the problem isn't you or I. It's not your listeners or my readers. The problem is the gangs and the criminals in Democrat-controlled cities in our country. And until we face that, we'll never fix anything.
You know, you make a really good point too about this day being a chance to virtue signal for a lot of celebrities, right? And it's a chance for the anti-gun activists to try to build their mailing list. But one thing we haven't seen from the gun control groups today, Dr. Hawkins, is specific policies, right? I mean,
right.
For Barack Obama, it's, well, wear orange and show your commitment to reducing gun violence. For Vogue magazine, they interviewed Shanna Watts and, you know, her tips on how to be effective. There were no policy prescriptions there as run for office, think local, talk to your members of Congress, but never what about. You know, when you talk to gun owners, we're talking about the Hearing Protection Act. We're talking about the National Right to Carry Reciprocity Act. We're talking about constitutional carry. They're so wrapped up in trying to build their brand as the common sense gun safety advocates that they're not talking about what they want. Well, what they say they want are just these common sense gun regulations, but they're not getting specific. They're not telling people, here's the law that we think needs to change. And, oh, by the way, here we think are the consequences of breaking these laws. I want to hear celebrities say, you know what? I want that woman in Chicago, Illinois, to go to prison for being a straw purchaser. I want these celebrities to actually talk about what they think should happen to people who break the gun control laws that they want to put on the books.
Oh, I agree with you 100%. You know, they're kind of like, you know how people talk about when it was Hillary Clinton versus Trump, people talked about Hillary had a problem because her ideas were the old ideas. She still had the old playbook. She tried to make them sound new, but they were old, not days old or weeks old, but decades old. You have the same problem with the gun control movement. If you pin one of them down, what are they still pushing? Universal background checks. What would universal background checks do to stop any mass shooting you can think of? Any mass shooting. I can't think of one that would have been stopped by universal background checks. And those that, there are many of them that didn't even deal with background checks, that didn't even deal with guns being sold because the guns were stolen. So that's how out of touch this group is. And then I'm like you. If we're going to push a gun law, do we also know what the ramifications will be? Like, let's take Jared Loeffner, who shot Gabby Giffords after he passed a background check for his handgun. He passed the background check. He got his handgun. Then he used it to shoot her. Then Gabby Giffords and her husband begged the court not to put him in a real prison, not to make him face the death penalty. I think six people were killed in that attack, though. Well, if there are not going to be any ramifications for criminal activity, the criminals are never going to quit with criminal activity. So this is all a foolish game. So I'm with you. But I don't think Second Amendment supporters, Cam, are ready to go to the mat on this and to really commit to having hard justice for people who use guns for crime.
You don't think Second Amendment opponents are prepared to do that?
Opponents, I apologize if I said it another way. You're right. Gun control proponents, Second Amendment opponents, not proponents. You're right. They push all these laws. They're not serious about fighting crime. All they want to do is find a way to curtail our practice of the Second Amendment. That's the ultimate goal. That's why they failed to this point. I believe the American people have figured that out.
I think more Americans are figuring it out by the day. You know, we saw the numbers. You reported this at Breitbart. May of 2017, we're back to setting NICS records, Dr. Hawkins, because the National Instant Criminal Background Check System, background checks for May, higher than May of 2016. So that's not been the case for the first 5 months of the year, first 4 months of the year, but that was the case in May. We do have, you know, more and more Americans who are becoming gun owners. We got record high numbers of concealed carry holders. And again, that's because they're deciding for themselves, all right, you know what, I want to take on this responsibility. I want to be able to protect myself. I want to be able to protect my loved ones. The gun control argument right now, I got to tell you, I mean, it's so vague and vacuous, and it's at odds with itself. You've got Kim Kardashian today writing about how, listen, oh, I know everybody has a right to keep and bear arms. She said, I'm not against guns, and I'm not against people owning guns after what happened to me in Paris. I know how important it is to be safe and have armed security, Dr. Hawkins. But she said, my armed security team also supports stricter gun control laws and believe that we should restrict access to firearms for people with mental illness, anyone previously convicted of a misdemeanor, those who have been subject to a temporary restraining order, and, quote, those at a higher risk of committing gun violence. Now, again, what does that mean, practically speaking? What does that mean in legislative form? If you've been diagnosed with a mental illness, so if you've been diagnosed with depression, if you're under a doctor's care, if you're getting treatment for that, if you no longer suffer from depression, does Kim Kardashian think you shouldn't be able to own a gun? And who decides who is at a, quote, higher risk of committing gun violence? If you live in a high crime neighborhood, if you are a young black man, I've got a 25-year-old biracial son. On paper, statistically, he might be at a higher risk of committing gun violence. I'm not concerned about my son committing a violent crime, but because of the color of his skin, because of the age that he is, does that mean that he doesn't get to own a firearm? I mean, again, these meaningless phrases do nothing but try to pad the anti-gun credentials, or the gun safety credentials of these celebrities who parrot these talking points. But what is it that they're actually calling for? What is it that they actually want to see on the books right now?
I don't think they know. I mean, I think you've hit the nail on the head, Cam. If you'll notice, I don't know if they're parroting Mom's Demand or if they're parroting Gabby Giffords, but you'll notice when all of these people come out against national reciprocity or campus carry, they use the same exact phrases. They oppose the carrying of hidden loaded guns in public. What?
Mm-hmm.
What? That's how they word it to make it sound ominous. And they're all using the same phrases. They don't understand what they're saying. They're just using the language. It's just talking points. And Kim Kardashian is doing the same thing. She's just using the talking points. My first reaction to her is, Kim, I don't care. That is, I don't care what you think. Number two, my second reaction is, I do care about this push, because all that will happen if Kardashian or anyone like her is successful, all that will happen is that law-abiding citizens will have a harder time getting the guns they need for self-defense. Criminals won't have any problem. Chicago, again, South Side is proof of that. So we have to understand that when Kim Kardashian sits in her elitist position and talks down to us and reaches down just for a moment to interact with us to tell us that we need to be careful with our guns, we can't be trusted with our guns. When she does that, we need to understand she has no idea what she's talking about. And even though it's the end thing for celebrities to do, to talk gun control, we have to understand that for the people, the end thing to do is to fight for freedom. And the fight for freedom means defending the Second Amendment. We can never budge on that, no matter how hayseed they make us look, no matter how stupid they try to make us look, we can never budge on that.
Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins at Breitbart. Listen, enjoy your Friday afternoon. Have fun. Be safe. And we look forward to doing this again very soon.
Right on. Great to be with you, buddy. God bless you.
Always good talk with you, man. Dr. A.W.R. Hawkins joining us from West Texas. Get ready to do a little shoot. He's signed off. He's probably already got a gun in hand. He's ready to go. Kicking off the weekend a little bit early. Good for him. Kim Kardashian West, by the way, also used this tired trope that anti-gun activists love to throw out there. Is it more important to protect the Second Amendment than to protect our own children? She wondered. Maybe you think so. Maybe you don't. But, she said, it's important for us to at least continue to discuss and debate this openly and to bring attention to the reality of gun violence and gun control. Let's talk more about this, Kim. Let's have that. Cameron, you know, if Kim Kardashian West wants to discuss and debate this openly as a father of five, I would love to debate that question. Is it more important to protect the Second Amendment than to protect our own children? Can you reach out to Kim Kardashian West? I know you've got her on speed dial.
I do. I will make sure we'll have it by the weekend.
Excellent. Fantastic. Because I'd love to talk to Kim Kardashian West. I'd love to have that conversation. Because as a father, no, it's not that the Second Amendment is more important to me than my children. My children, my family, the most important thing to me in the world. But I want to be able to protect my family. When I'm not around, I want my wife to be able to protect herself. Actually, when I'm around, I want my wife to be able to protect herself, and she can. But I want her to be able to protect our children. I want my kids to have that knowledge of how to handle a firearm safely and responsibly. And I've taught my kids, I've taught all my kids how to do that. Some of them like shooting more than others. That's okay. Again, I've got five, so they're all very different. But it's not about loving my guns or loving the Second Amendment more than I love my kids. It's about protecting my family and being able to do so. No matter where I live, if I live in Farmville, Virginia, or if I live in Midtown Manhattan. And, you know, again, Kim, we don't all have armed security. It's great that you do. I'm not, maybe a little envious, but not really. That's fantastic. Enjoy your armed security. Have as many armed security guards as you want. I can't. Can't even have one. I am my own armed security. I am my kids' bodyguard. And there are millions of Americans out there, moms and dads, who are in the same position that I'm in. We are the ones responsible for protecting the most important things in our life. And we use firearms to protect those most important things in our life. We do it safely. We do it responsibly. But we don't need a lecture from an anti-gun celebrity. Happy to have that debate, though. Happy to have that debate. Just if Kanye comes along, he can't take the microphone like he did with Taylor Swift. We just don't allow that. That's just rude. All right, when we come back here on this edition of Cam and Company, Tony Katz from WIBC should be recovered from the Indianapolis 500, and it is National Donut Day, so we know Tony's excited about that. Stick around. We will be right back with more Cam and Company right after this.
Two of my favorite people are here, the Girls with Guns, Jen and Narissa. So this is kind of a new thing, right? I mean, not the Girls with Guns clothing, but the expansion, how big you all have gotten that now you've got your booth space. You were at SHOT Show with your booth space, and this is a big step for you all
for
as a company.
Our first time having a booth at SHOT Show, and we were so excited. We feel so blessed to be able to grow from our garage to where we are today.
Can you talk about how you did that? Because this is, you know, look, I think it's a great entrepreneurial story, and I know that there are people out there right now who say, I've got an idea, but I don't know how to take it from in my head to end it up right here. So how do you do that?
Well, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears. No, that just... Narissa and I have really put in a ton of hours, I mean, for the last 8 years. We've given up parts of our life, our family time, and really, I mean, we've just stuck together. And I think that's the main thing is drive, ambition, and knowing what you want and seeing that end goal. And we aren't there yet. We're in the teenage stages of our company, and I just feel like we're ready to take on the world and really stand up for our Second Amendment rights and our hunting rights and make our voices heard as women in the outdoor industry.
So you all have more plans to come. You want to keep getting bigger, keep growing.
I think there's so much opportunities for our brand, you know, from garage to where we are today. And, you know, just expanding with a hunting line, and, you know, we have some future plans. of wink, wink. Can't really say it yet, but stay tuned.
Okay.
We can't tell you that yet.
All
but
right.
Maybe next year we'll have a quick chat about it.
Can we get an exclusive when you all are ready to reveal this?
I would love that. Okay. I would love that. It's
right.
It's going to be very special, and I think you'll love it, too.
Okay.
And
so,
it has to do with, well...
Come on. Come on. You can't do that.
We did give a little quick sneak peek to Carrie Lightfoot with the well-armed woman. So.
Okay, I'll have to go bug her then.
Yeah,
spill the beans, Carrie. Let me know what's going on. So what is the mission of Girls with Guns? What do your customers want from you? And why do your customers come to you?
You know, what I really feel like Narissa and I stand for, which means Girls with Guns stands for, is just empowering women in every state. Because it's not just hunting. It's not just about our Second Amendment rights. It's about just sticking together as women and being strong and really getting out there. Whether you're looking at our new tank tops where we're backing the LEOs, Back the Blue, that was just an idea from our digital marketing manager whose husband is an LEO. And we are really working on just getting out there in our community and doing as much as we can to support every different facet of it with our Second Amendment right. Whether it's hunting, guns, legislator, whatever we can do, and that's where we're going to be focusing.
Do you think that your customer base are they activists? Are they involved in the Second Amendment, or is this? Because I imagine you want them to be. You don't want this just to be a fashion statement. You want this to be a statement of principle here.
Yeah, I would say so. And it was Well, right now we're launching a Second Amendment collection here. And, you know, it's pretty amazing when you do see some of our customers and they're coming by and they saying, I am the Second Amendment. And to see them walking by, I know that they're taking that stance and they're showing it and they're wearing it proudly. And it just makes my heart so happy to see that.
That is fantastic. You know, I got to ask, too, we've seen some gun shaming, I think, when it comes to women. We've got anti-gun activists who say, don't own a gun, ladies, right? It's gonna make your life more dangerous. You're going to be miserable. Don't own a gun. At the same time, they say they're not anti-gun. They're just in favor of gun safety, right? But it is this attitude of, well, the only way to be safe is to not own a firearm. Clearly, there are more and more women who are rejecting that argument. Are you hearing from a lot of new gun owners?
Absolutely, and that's actually one of our focuses this year is getting out and mentoring our youth, and we've been doing that for years already. Teaching them proper gun handling is where it's at. It's about firearm safety. It's not about not owning a gun. That is our right. It is our Second Amendment right, and I carry a firearm every day. I have my concealed carry permit. It's my Ruger 380 LCP, and it's been on me for 6 years, and it is something that I firmly believe in, my right to defend myself if ever needed, and I hope I never have to use that. I'm 5 foot tall. If I was stuck in a dark alley with somebody much bigger than me, I wouldn't have a choice if they were trying to attack me or defending my home, and that is my right, and I've always felt very strongly about that from the time I was a kid. That's how I was raised, and I just think that we stand up for that and teaching women the right way to handle firearms and so that they're not afraid of them. That's what we're about.
Welcome back to Cam and Company here on NRA TV, Sirius XM Patriot 125 and more. Hashtag Donut Day Indy 2017. It is trending at WIBC.com. Tony Katz of WIBC is with us on the program. Tony, how many donuts have you had today?
Oddly enough, my day involved bites of donuts, but no actual complete donuts. So I have no way of answering that question.
Oh, that's good. So you just take a bite and then you, because you were trying donuts out, right? Were you picking the best donut in Indy today?
I was not one of the judges because that would be wrong of me to do. But I keep tabs on the important things.
Okay, you got to do quality control, right?
Clearly, and when you are surrounded by 4,000 donuts, I do what I can.
Do you recall a favorite that you nibbled on today?
Well, one of the winners was the Reese's Peanut Butter Cup donut. It was a Long John that was stuffed with peanut butter, and then it had a peanut butter cup topping, and it was just a good, solid Long John kind of donut.
Dude, how did you stop with just a bite of that one? How did you not just tear into that whole thing?
Well, you know, I'm a man of much control.
Well, good for you. I would have polished that off, but Reese's peanut butter cups are my weak link.
Are they really?
Yeah, they really are.
Very manly of you.
Hey, you know what? I'm not afraid to admit it. Reese's peanut butter cups are awesome. Peanut butter and chocolate, those are two great tastes that go great together, Tony.
You know what? That could be an ad campaign. Someone write that down. Come on.
We should get to work on that. So how was Indy 500 weekend?
Indy 500 was unbelievable. An incredible ending, an incredible race. Some guys lucky to be alive. Scott Dixon going over the back of Jay Howard. At 226 miles an hour, flying through the air. If it wasn't for the catch fence and the way he landed, he's not alive today. An amazing accident to have witnessed, and that he walked away. The safety skill of IndyCar and what they've developed is remarkable. How these guys walk away is unbelievable. But as for a good time and the show we were doing, it's the best gig in the world. To be able to do the pre-race for the Indianapolis 500 is just too cool for school, and I'm lucky I get to do it.
That's awesome, man. So you had a great weekend, and then you come back, and boy, it's been a crazy week. I'm curious, how much have you talked about the what I would consider the silly stuff, like Kathy Griffin? Obviously, you were off the air when you had her press conference. Will you talk about this on Monday, or will you just let this one go?
I'm actually going to take a couple of days off, but I won't be letting it go because I don't believe it's the silly stuff. So we're clear, it's not the silly stuff. The first part, which is the photo she took, wasn't silly stuff. It was, look at me, and let's see how outrageous I could be. And as we all know, the left is going to protect me. And then, oh my goodness, the left didn't protect me because, wow, this is really unfunny, this picture I took, and pretty damn sick. And it is. It's unfunny. It's sick. And it goes to showing off exactly how just beyond themselves, beside themselves, so many on the American left are with the election of Donald Trump. They can't even allow for basic humanity to get on board. And you got to remember, this isn't the first time we've seen this. Mm-hmm. We saw people do this with effigies of Obama. We saw the stamp of President Bush with the gun to his head, Bush 43. This isn't the first time, this is the last time that it will happen. What's important about it is that the first time we saw some unity in the country, people on the left and people on the right, Chelsea Clinton and I agree that what Kathy Griffin did was pretty damn gross. Well, if we can get people agreeing on that, we've got a nice base. Let's see what we can build on top of that. Today's press conference is everything. I'm going to say, and I haven't said it anywhere until now, Kathy Griffin attempted today in her press conference to set women back 100 years. That's what she did today, trying to call herself a victim, crying about how President Trump, her words, he broke me. That was that hashtag, he broke me. I don't know if it's trending. That is such a sick and twisted, and like somehow Donald Trump committed some kind of violent act against Kathy Griffin. Look at me, woe is me, I'm the victim, poor me. I thought I was tough, I thought I was strong, but the minute the heat came on me, all of a sudden I'm afraid and I'm just a woman, and look what she did to me. She set women back, or tried to, 100 years. What's important to remember is that there are a tremendous amount of women out there who look at Kathy Griffin and said, oh, my God, is she out of her skull? She does not talk for me. Hey, daughter of mine. Hey, sister of mine. Hey, grandmother of mine. You see that? Let's never be like that. That's the only saving grace there. But that's what she attempted to do with this nonsense lawyer of hers, who I've learned only recently is the daughter of Gloria Allred. Is that true?
It is. It is true.
Oh, well. Well, that's good to know. I guess Robert Shapiro was busy. You know, you find who you can. Well, the difference is Robert Shapiro knows how to win a case. You're right.
But here's the thing. So she hired Lisa Bloom, right? Have the press conference. Why'd she hire an attorney, Tony? I mean, she's not announcing any sort of litigation. There's nothing she could litigate here. Why did she even appear with an attorney? I don't understand that.
I think there's a possibility that she might get herself into further legal trouble. Mm. She may have already had some kind of conversation with the Secret Service or others. So she put herself in a position to be safe, and lawyers can sometimes be publicists, and that's what's going on here. She appeared with her lawyer as a great line from, you know, to generate some publicity. But two things. Of course I'm talking about this story. Exposing this story is what got people to say this is disgusting. Everybody who doesn't understand culture and everybody who tries to eschew culture needs to look at this story. It mattered that people talked about it, and we found some common agreement. And then you got to take a look at the part two, where she tries to play the victim. She tries to play the weak, weak little child. And she tries to use a canard where somehow the big man is frightening her. Gross and horrific, and she tried to set women back 100 years. And I want to see National Organization of Women and other women's groups say that's absolutely not how we act. You got to take responsibility in this world. And man, did she try and do us in a bad way.
Well, speaking of taking responsibility, let's talk about Hillary Clinton this week, finding yet another reason.
She's already set women back. There's nothing I can do about that.
Another reason why Hillary Clinton didn't win in 2016, she discovered this week, was the work of the DNC, right? And all of the data that they were doing, it was all garbage, according to Hillary Clinton. You know, it's always interesting to see the left turn on itself, Tony. And we've seen this on college campuses, but now we're seeing, you know, look, when it was Russia, when it was Comey, when it was misogyny, the left happy to go along with Hillary Clinton, right? Oh yeah, all those things were to blame. As soon as she starts, you know, well, it was also, you know, folks on our side too. That's all of a sudden when this has become a bridge too far. And I think there are a lot on the left who will be willing to move on and ready to move on from Hillary Clinton going forward.
But what if they don't? Listen, these are the people who are still in the corner of Hillary Clinton. This is Stockholm Syndrome. That's all it is and all it could ever be. They're unserious people. If Hillary Clinton thought that the DNC was doing such a poor job, why did she work so hard to have them beat the living crap out of Bernie Sanders, to push him to the side so she could get the nomination? And what happened to this idea? I thought that Donald Trump was a moron. Donald Trump was a putz. The RNC had no idea what to do with him. They had no data collection. They had no ground game. They had nothing. All of a sudden, Orca, which failed Mitt Romney, that was the system that they were going to use to get out the vote, was the greatest thing since the invention of the Internet. Not since the invention of the polio vaccine have we had such a jump in technology. The first 5,000-year jump was everything we've seen the United States create via capitalism. The next 5,000-year jump was Orca. Since when did that happen? Donald Trump went from being a schmuck to being the Bill Gates of our time. It's amazing how this happens in the eyes of Hillary Clinton.
It is. Tony Katz from WIBC. So speaking of, is he back to, I mean, this is the thing, though. It depends on, like, it doesn't even depend on what day of the week it is. It depends on what time of the day it is as to whether or not Donald Trump is this Machiavellian a genius or whether or not he's just a blooming idiot, right? And so with Trump pulling out of the Paris Climate Accords yesterday, is this the evil Machiavellian Trump, or is this the left's character of Trump as a buffoon who pulled out of the Paris Climate Accord?
There has never been anything. There are Broadway shows less choreographed than the outrage you saw yesterday of Trump pulling out of the Paris Accords. Nathan Lane gave a standing ovation to the left for the best choreography he's ever seen. It's unbelievable. Harvey Fierstein said, not since Kinky Boots has there been such fine dancing. I heard that Lin-Manuel Miranda gave up his Tony to the American left. They did such a good job with this bit of theater. This is no big deal. Because it was no big deal when it was signed. It was a bad idea when it was signed by Barack Obama in 2015. Getting out of it is the right thing to do, because with all of these things, we're never talking about climate. The purpose of the Paris Accord is to try and keep global temperatures from increasing 2 degrees centigrade by the year 2100. Island nations want to see 1.5 degrees. Even some of the best scientists in the world don't think that you're going to be able to do anything to shave off anything regarding how climate might move. And, oh, by the way, it's to the tune of $100 billion a year, basically forever. If we're going to spend $100 billion a year, do we really need France, Germany, and Italy to tell us how to do it? We can't do that one ourselves. Let's put $100 billion a year into our own country. Let's put it into planting a tree. Let's put it into cleaning up streams. Let's put, oh, you know, whatever the EPA did to ruin Colorado under Barack Obama's tenure. And why can't we spend the money that way? If we're going to spend $100 billion a year, why not spend it on us? But the objective of the Paris Accords, like all of these conversations, is wealth redistribution, not the environment. That's what Al Gore wants to make his money. That's what Tom Steyer wants to make his money. It's all Earth Charter. Their basic charter dictates wealth redistribution. That will never, ever, ever clean up a stream. It will never do anything about the environment. It will only make you poor and a slave. So, yeah, getting out of the Paris Accord is the worst thing in the world.
Tony Katz with WIBC. Listen, buddy, we are almost out of time, but thank you, as always, for coming on the program. Go actually eat an entire donut before the end of the day, okay?
Actually, I'm going to a beer festival tonight. I've got no time. But I'm a busy man. It's donuts in the morning, it's beer in the evening. Welcome to Indiana. Why? Where do you live? Virginia?
Yes, I do, and I'll be having some barbecue. We do have beer here in Virginia. In fact, we've got a brewery opening up in Farmville, Tony. How about that? Enjoy the beer fest, buddy. Yeah, be safe. Have fun this weekend. We will be back Monday, live 2 p.m. Eastern on NRA TV, midnight Eastern, 9 Pacific on SiriusXM Patriot 125. We'll see you with another edition of Cam and Company after the weekend.